Hi, folks. We got a new sponsor, and I've been using this quite a bit lately. It's called Plaud. It is the Plaud Note Pro. It is basically a dedicated AI note-taking device that records conversations, automatically organizes them into transcripts, into summaries, has different speakers it will label, gives you action items. I mean, my use cases for this, I imagine if you're in business, there's a ton of things. And if you're a doctor or something like this, but as a parent, very helpful. When you go, let's say, just hypothetically, I'm not saying I did this, record your son after he's getting put under for oral surgery. And then also, of course, the doctor gives you a bunch of instructions and you can record. It organizes it, puts it into a file. Then you can send it to your co-parent. That's just one use case. But also for me, I use it for ideas and whatnot. And the thing is, I thought like, well, why don't I just use my phone for this? But my problem is that when I pick up my phone, I do 10 things before I get to the thing that I was going to do. And then I forget to do it. And your voice memos get lost on there. This is all organized. It's incredible. And it will not only that, it will record long form conversations. There's no battery drain. Like I say, no interruptions. And it it can record your phone calls, too. Wow. Now, you need consent, at least in third party states or in non-third party states. But nevertheless, you know, your mileage will vary on that. It's also encrypted. It's privacy compliant. And if your work involves interviews, meetings, researches, organizing, production, any type of conversation oriented type of work, this thing becomes very useful very quickly. Also, again, like it's a great mechanism to communicate when you got stuff that you're recording of. But you go down to your cat. What do you need for the food? Oh, I don't want to write these notes and send them off. It's so easy. Go to Plaud. Oh, and mine comes on a I got a case. They give it to everybody, but it sticks on the back of your phone with magnets. Yep. Unless your son takes it because he's upset that you might have recorded him. Go to Plaud, Plaud.ai/majority. Use the code majority for 10% off. Check it out. The link will be in the podcast and YouTube description. Now time for the show.
With Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, May 27th, 2026. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Alex Jaquez, Chief of Policy and Advocacy Work at Groundwork Collaborative, former Special Assistant to President for Economic Development and Industrial Strategy under the Obama administration. And what we can look forward to in the price of oil and food in the coming weeks, months, years. Also on the program today, Matt Duss, Executive Vice President at the Center for International Policy, the co-host of the Undiplomatic podcast on both the failure of the Abraham Accords and the commensurate failure of the Democratic foreign policy establishment, and how it's starting to look like they are personas non grata. Also on the program today, Paxton wins as Republicans scrubbing of his record and their criticisms of him commences. Congressman Al Green, latest AIPAC victim in Texas. Johnny Garcia wins in Texas 35th. Meanwhile, Iranians back online as the internet's been flipped back on there. Meanwhile, that ceasefire, not really a ceasefire anymore. South Carolina legislature rejects gerrymandering, probably because they saw how many people came out to vote in the primary and it didn't look good for them. Florida judge lets the new Republican map proceed. Israel once again bombing Gaza, killing 14 while killing 31 in Lebanon. This should make you feel uncomfortable. The CDC has asked for volunteers to help with Ebola screening at airports. Now, to be fair, they're asking CDC employees to go volunteer because apparently all the ones who were trained in this were cut. Protest continues at the New Jersey ICE facility as an AP investigation finds huge rate of suicides in ICE detention centers. Peel's court temporarily blocks the Trump regime from deporting Mahmoud Khalil. And Icelanders will vote over the summer whether to attempt to join the EU to gain protection from the United States. All this and more on today's Majority Report. It is
hump day.
Yeah. Why are people saying your mic?
I'm saying my mic is low, so I want to be able to put the full weight behind my proclamation of.
There we go.
Hump day. It's hump day.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. It is hump day. We got a lot to get to. Obviously, these runoffs in Texas yesterday. Another one bites the dust. John Cornyn was 20 years ago. He was considered an absolute fringe character in the Senate. And now he's just not Republican enough for them. He's got no criminal record that we know of. No impeachments. No weird sexual assaults. As far as we know, no affairs. None of the things that it takes
to be Republican.
Does he really even want it? You have to ask.
Yeah, and it's amazing. Cornyn, yes, like show some commitment, buddy, to the criminality. Cornyn had apparently the worst showing for an incumbent in a head-to-head primary or runoff since 1974.
I did not go too deep into it, but it looks like Paxton got about 40,000 more votes than he did in the primary, and Cornyn got like hundreds of thousands of votes less.
It's amazing. It seems like every one of Texas's, if at least the overwhelming majority, 254 counties, swung in the direction of the criminal, basically, the guy that has a litany of corruption issues and investigations, was indicted on securities fraud, amongst other things. So, total Trump guy.
Total Trump guy. And Republicans seem to be really freaking out about this. And we'll show some examples of what they've had to scrub from the internet. But here is Paxton, and he has gone to the Donald Trump school of nicknaming your opponent. That, of course, is James Tallarico. And look, well, let's hear what Paxton had to say.
My opponent is the most extreme radical the Democrats have ever nominated. He's even running a vegan campaign, whatever that is. He goes by a few names that you may all have heard of.
Pause it for 1 second. Also, I just want to say, like, you know, it is quite clear that Cornyn ran up against a guy with a tremendous amount of charisma and ability to deliver a riveting, emotionally invested speech.
whatever that means. I'm not going to tell you. I'm just going to throw it out there.
I've done commercial reads, pre-taped commercial reads that have more dynamism than this.
Well, I mean, he's trying to do the Trump nickname thing, but with none of the Trump charisma. And I just, like, substitute vegan for, like, gay or some sort of gay slur or effeminate, and you'll probably get a sense of what he's trying to get at there.
He's going
to
get more explicit.
By a few names that you may all have heard of. Some people know him as Tofu Tallarico. Some people call him Six-Gender Jimmy. I've even heard some people call him James Tallarico. And others refer to him simply as Low-T Tallarico. But no matter what you call him, let me tell you this. James Tallarico is a threat to everything we hold dear in this state and in this country. He's a threat to our security and our safety. He wants open borders and even said a welcome mat should be at our southern border. He's a threat to our children. He wants boys and girls sports, gender mutilation surgery performed on kids. And when asked what he loved outside of his family and friends, you heard what Brandon Gill said. His first answer was trans kids. That's weird, and that's a radical guy. He's a threat to our prosperity and Texas economy. He said you can't be a Christian if you support the oil and gas industries. He wants to raise your taxes, and he won't do a single thing to lower costs for you and your family. And finally,
Yeah, the cost thing is going to be an issue for them. I'm not sure necessarily this brand of schoolyard bullying paired with the Trump administration's sadism as this very... The state with a large Latino population has to face ICE harassing their communities and kidnapping their neighbors. I'm not sure that the whole schoolyard bully thing plays in the same way at that point, especially when Trump's at 60% disapproval.
I'm going to be a little bit, you know, listen. I've seen Texas so many times sound like it's going to be really close. I think it's probably going to be the best shot that Democrats have for a senatorial race in Texas, and certainly in my, well, not my lifetime. Lloyd Benston was there. I'm that old, but it's certainly within the past several decades. But who knows? Because I think like the whole schoolyard bully thing seems about as Texas as anything, right? I mean, literally the motto of the state is don't mess with Texas. But we'll see. In the meantime, though, the problem is that I think for a long time, the Republicans thought Ken Paxton had no chance. The guy is so toxic. Even our diehard authoritarian followers
psychos, yeah,
are going to have a problem with this guy. So like just a month or two ago, they're writing stuff like this. This is from the National Republican Senate campaign
senatorial committee.
Ken Paxton using taxpayer dollars to buy hotel rooms for donors.
Oh, good to know.
Let's see what else they had. Ken Paxton's lies and incompetence keep piling up. Back in July, this is in 2025. Ken Paxton in standing in conservatives' ways. Oh, gosh, Ken. And the statement on Angela Paxton's decision to divorce Ken Paxton. Now, of course, they've literally
part of the affair
been scrubbing their website to get rid of all these press releases. But
they were very active in trying to elevate candidates or depress them in these primaries. Like the Republicans were also, it seems like, elevating Jasmine Crockett. There was reporting about how there was a Republican group that kind of convinced her to run via this campaign of getting her voters to ask her to run. So they didn't succeed there, and they did not succeed here.
Now, here is Ken Paxton with a wonderful is this from his yearbook? Oh, no, actually, I'm sorry. It seems to be.
Have a great sentence.
The top data point is sell, lower level booking.
let's see.
Is his face on a diagonal?
There is some weird stuff going on with this.
I think they caught him with a fishing line.
Let's see. Case warrant number 416819142015. Fraud. sell securities for over $100,000. Then, of course, he's got a second warrant for fraud, sell securities over $100,000, and then investment advisor or representative without registration. Oh, that's nice.
I do have to admit, unfortunately, Ken Paxton is a North Dakotan.
Ooh.
Wow.
Well, there you go.
Total carpetbagger.
Carpetbagger. Carpetbagger Ken.
He also, I forgot about this. I was reading an article about some of just his litany of issues this morning, that in 2013 he was caught on camera stealing an $1,000 pen.
you know, you only have so many chances at $1,000 pen.
I mean, so just it just shows how committed he is to the true MAGA way.
Here is James Tallarico on, I guess it's just a this MS Now interview with him, talking about Ken Paxton and his attacks on him.
What about Texas voters who want to know from you on this particular issue? Is Ken Paxton telling the truth about you? In relation to these issues, especially involving what he was just talking about there, transgender issues involving children?
No, Ken Paxton is clipping comments, taking them out of context to try to paint a picture, trying to paint me as someone I'm not. You know, Ken Paxton has a criminal record. I have a legislative record over four terms in the Texas House of Representatives, where I've brought Democrats and Republicans together to pass more than 60 bipartisan bills to cut property taxes, to raise teacher pay, to lower the cost of housing, prescription drugs, and child care across Texas. And I'm going to put that record up against Ken Paxton's criminal record any day of the week, twice on Sunday. I've called out the extremes in both parties, on the right and the left. You know, I've called out Ken Paxton for his blatant illegal corruption, but I also called out President Biden when he failed to secure our southern border. So I'm not interested in going to Washington, D.C. to serve one political party. I'm going to Washington, D.C. to serve the people of Texas. That's the exact opposite of what Ken Paxton does. He serves himself and his billionaire mega donors at the expense of the people of the state.
Now, the interesting thing about this, aside from, like, you know, he's, I mean, this is how he's going to run, I think, is basically like, Ken Paxton's a criminal. This is not too dissimilar from the Jones-Roy Moore race in 2019. No, I'm sorry. This must have been in 2017 or so when that seat had to be filled because Jeff Sessions was made the attorney general. That was a special election. You know, if Tallarico manages to get in, he's in for 6 years, and that is a lot longer of a time. And, you know, Texas moving in certain to the extent that it's moving purple, you know, he'll be locked in. But I just want to note, like, if you look at the way that the left is responding to Tallarico, which is like, OK, the guy's not talking as a partisan. Of course, he's running in Texas.
Right.
He's not out there, you know, he's trying to tack towards the middle. All well and good. You look at the way the left is responding to that, which is, we need a pickup in Texas. We'll take it. Versus, like, the way the Democratic establishment, conservative Democrats, near Republicans in many instances, are reacting to Plattner. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
And Abdul al-Sayed.
We'll
get to that soon, I'm sure. But I think it's the way that Tallarico's tacking to the middle that's important. He's not throwing trans kids under the bus. He's not even, you know, he'll say strong southern border, but he's not throwing immigrants under the bus. You know, I don't, if he's able to talk about the criminality and the cruelty of MAGA and then contrast it with his sort of Boy Scout kindness thing, I think it's a poignant message. And I didn't know this, or I'd forgotten, that Tallarico was a part of the team that prosecuted Paxton during his impeachment hearings in the House. So he's trying to use his strength as a strength in this race because he has intimate knowledge of his corruption.
I think what we're going to see is at least a decent amount of people just not go out and vote on the Republican side. And then it just becomes how much voter interference are we going to see in Texas, which I think you can't underestimate. But we will have more to say about this in the coming months, without a doubt. A couple of words from our sponsor, and then we'll be talking to Alex Jaquez, Chief of Policy Advocacy at the Groundwork Collaborative. Everybody has a can't miss fitness training hack. Well, I don't. But a lot of people do. You know, everybody thinks it's like the silver bullet. That's how I used to feel about hair growth products. Just a lot of hype. But what changed for me was literally just starting to take Nutrafol. They wanted us to sponsor the program years and years ago. They sent us some product. Nobody in the office needed it at the time or wanted it. Then a couple years ago, I felt like I was starting to thin. And I started taking it in part because you said you had a friend who had taken it. And my girlfriend knew somebody who had taken it successfully. It is physician formulated. It's clinically tested. It's recommended by dermatologists. And it's not, you know, it's not drugs, it's supplement. So I tried it. And I've had great success. And now Nutrafol offers hair growth supplements tailored for men at every age because the root causes of hair thinning change over time. Your routine should, too. Nutrafol for men ages 18 to 49 to help improve their hair growth and achieve thicker, fuller hair in 3 to 6 months. And new Nutrafol men 50+, which is what I am taking now. And it came a little bit late based upon my age, I got to tell you. The first and only hair growth product specifically formulated for men 50+. I have seen a marked difference in the amount of hair I shed based upon my towel test. And also just the thickness of my hair is maintained. Adding Nutrafol to your daily routine is easy. You order online, no prescription needed. Automated deliveries, free shipping to keep you on track. Plus, with Nutrafol subscription, you can save up to 20% and get added perks to support your hair growth journey. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement. It is trusted by over 1.5 million people, including me. Start Nutrafol today. Make the hat optional. Visit Nutrafol.com. Enter promo code TMR10 for $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping. Find out why Nutrafol is the best-selling hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com, spelled NutraFol.com, promo code TMR10. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code TMR10. We'll put the information in the podcast and YouTube descriptions, of course, as always. Also, one of my early dilemmas when we started this show was merch. I didn't want to have a merch shop. I thought it would be too much of a pain in the butt. It's not a huge moneymaker, particularly, you know, we wanted to use union labor, wanted to have a U.S. Material, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, then it's going to be just too much of a pain in the ass. How do we update it? How do we keep track of it? Mm-hmm. How do we do all this? What if we sell it offline? On and on and on. And then, of course, we found the answer. Shopify. Shopify was a all-in-one solution. It is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world. 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, from household names to brands just getting started. It's super easy to do. You get started with your own design studio. They have hundreds of ready-to-use templates. Shopify helps you build beautiful online store to match your brand style. Or if your brand style is not beautiful, you can match that like we did. You get the word out. They have a marketing team behind you, essentially. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. Best yet, Shopify is your commerce expert with world-class expertise in everything from managing inventory to international shipping to processing returns and beyond. And what if I get stuck? Well, Shopify is always around to share advice. They have award-winning 24/7 customer support. You can tackle all of those tasks in one place. Inventory to payments to analytics and more. You don't need to save multiple websites or try and figure out which platform is hosting the tool that you need. Everything all in one place, making your life easier and your business operations smoother. And they also have that Shop Pay button that's used by millions of businesses around the world. It's why Shopify has the best converting checkout on the planet. Also helps boost conversions. That means less carts going abandoned and more sales for you. It is time to turn those what ifs into hello with Shopify today. Sign up for a $1 per month trial and start selling at shopify.com/majority. Go to shopify.com/majority. Shopify.com/majority. Check it out. All right, quick break. When we come back, Alex Jaquez, Chief of Policy and Advocacy at Groundwork Collaborative, on what we can expect in terms of oil prices, food prices, all sorts of inflation. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Alex Jaquez, Chief of Policy and Advocacy at Groundwork Collaborative, former Special Assistant to the President of the Economic Development and Industrial Strategy under the Obama administration. Alex, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
For a couple of minutes this weekend, seemed like there was going to be some type of deal with Iran. And then I think all of the people who surround President Trump said, you can't do this because everyone's going to realize that you lost this war and that Iran is double the strength that it was before. And we're going to have a permanent rise in oil prices. Where are we with this? And because you've written this piece about the windfall profits for oil companies. Maybe let's start there, because I'm not convinced that they aren't saying, like, just keep going for it, because they're just making money hand over fist because of this.
If they aren't saying to keep going for it, they're at least not pushing for any changes right now. I think repeatedly the Trump administration has said that because the United States is a major oil and gas producer, because the United States actually is self-sufficient in terms of volume and the amount of oil that it produces, that we are able to weather this storm better than other countries. And what we've seen is, of course, quite the opposite. Right now, and since really the ceasefire conversation started, oil's been hovering about $100 a barrel, depending on your measurement and on the day. And gas has been continually rising. We're now sitting around $4.50, $4.55, getting up close to $5 in several states. And over, the Trump administration is saying, well, we're just going to drill, baby, drill, and get out of this ourselves. And what the oil companies are saying is, no, we're not. We're going to take that cash that they're getting from selling their oil for $100 a barrel, and they're going to give it back to shareholders. And this is a common kind of thread that we've seen over the last several years happen in the wake of the Ukraine invasion, that really they're, like you said, they're making money hand over fist right now. I think it's hard to blame them entirely. Certainly, they didn't press the big $5 a gallon gas button, the President Trump did, but certainly are not making it any more or any less painful for consumers right now who are really struggling at the pump.
Wait, you know, as this went on and it became clear, like, oh, this is fantastic for them because they're just getting this premium without a single dollar more invested in whatever they're doing. And they've been explicit, like, we're not going to expand our refining capacity. We're not going to do any of this. I mean, it really honestly is like, it's like the podcast business. We put out this product every day. If 5 million people showed up tomorrow to become members, it's not going to cost us any more to produce this. That's not happening. But I could see that it would be in my best interest to try and figure out a way to get those 5 million more viewers to come in. Like, are they not, like, how much of their lobbying? I just can't. It's hard for me not to imagine, like, there isn't some crossover between the sort of the military industrial complex and big oil. I mean, he went in and told big oil, if you give me money, I'm going to make you guys very, very wealthy. There has to be some lobbying around the they obviously didn't press the button, like you say, but there has to be some strong encouragement from them. Like, I would keep at this for a little bit longer.
I think there's certainly been lobbying by the oil companies in particular to counter what President Trump was saying earlier in his term, where he really wanted cheap gas and cheap oil. And this upset them quite a bit. And these are guys who, and there are mostly guys who are traditionally, it would be Trump, some of Trump's strongest supporters. And so they have certainly been lobbying to try to get that barrel price up, and they are definitely not going to be investing anymore, as certainly if the kind of trajectory stays right now where those longer term prices are still down. They're going to keep collecting profits. And of course, they have close ties to the administration all over the place, including right at the Secretary of Energy and Secretary of Interior as well, who are big oil boosters.
And I'm sorry. No. I would just lastly, I would imagine from their perspective, Iran taking a toll from ships passing through the Strait of Hormuz, they got to be all for it, right? I mean, because it's going to increase the cost of oil coming out of the Gulf there, but it's not going to increase their costs, and their oil is going to cost exactly the same to pull out of the ground and ship to wherever it is.
And they're not investing in production capacity right now either, right? I mean, sorry, Sam, go on.
Yeah, no, but that's the point.
The point is, yeah.
Yeah, for the United States specifically, I mean, we import, of course, very little to the United States directly through the Strait of Hormuz, and certainly we don't export a ton through it either. And so we are our oil companies are in a favorable environment in so much that it's not their tankers or their insurance who are going to take the hits. They are just going to reap the rewards of that mechanically higher price that we were going to get if the passage through the Strait of Hormuz becomes more dangerous and if those tolls are imposed on a go-forward basis.
If you could just tell us a little bit more about what Groundwork found, too, about what the profits actually look like. Who are the players that are going to benefit the most in particular? And I guess, I mean, even if you can expand it more broadly to how Trump has shifted from what you're saying, from low costs, all this stuff, to talking about how American oil companies are going to get rich. Which is true, but he seems to completely not have object permanence about, you know, like voters.
That's exactly right. And the big players here are the ones you've heard of. It's Exxon, it's Shell, it's Chevron. They are doing well. They are doing phenomenally well. And we'll see, particularly in their second quarter earnings, when a lot of this these realized profits are really going to be hitting. But just in the first quarter, we had Exxon had a bit of a derivative issue, but have kind of recently disclosed they expected internal nearly $9 billion in profits. We've seen Shell post a $7 billion, $6.9 billion profits in Q1, and they're expecting to double and even triple those in the months ahead. And so quarter two and quarter three will be phenomenal for these companies, and the stock market is showing it. We talk about how consumer sentiment is the lowest it's ever been, but the stock market is higher than it's ever been. And it's those big tech companies that are spending on data centers. They see big oil companies. If you see Exxon is up 28% over just since the year began. They're up 40% since year over year. And they're taking almost all of this cash. And to your point, Emma, they're not reinvesting it in new production. They're not, certainly not giving it back to consumers in any sort of way, but distributing nearly all of that in buybacks. We're seeing probably a $20 billion buyback plan from Exxon and from Chevron, and $3 billion a month from Shell as well. So a lot of cash returning to shareholders from this war so far, and it'll only be more the longer that it drags on.
And I would imagine some of the biggest shareholders of those companies are the CEO, the CFO, the COO, half a dozen other people in the C-suite, board of directors. I mean, this is, when we talk about shareholders, yes, there's a lot of shareholders, but the biggest ones are in control of the company and are going to reap the rewards of their like little side project, which is, you know, why or how their compensation is completely tied to the value of the stock. Right. I mean, all right. Well, let me also ask this. Do we have a sense of like what the costs are going to be for oil? Like, how far out now can we be confident and say, like, we're not getting back down to $3 a gallon for at least this amount of time? A and B, what will that do for renewables if we get an administration in a couple years from now that is not overtly hostile to some type of renewable energy?
Yeah, so this is going to take years to fully resolve, particularly to the point where it was back before the war started. And again, all of this is contingent on the war ending and for passage through the Strait of Hormuz to reopen and return to normal, which again, all things are go completely back to normal, will still take months for that refining capacity, for the tanker capacity to ramp back up, and for that flow to be resumed. But if you look at the EIA, this is the Energy Information Administration with the Department of Energy. This is, you know, the Trump administration right now putting these numbers out. They don't see crude oil falling back below $80 a barrel until 2027, and they don't see gas returning to $3 a gallon anytime in their forecasts, and think it'll be more fully elevated in that $3.50 range for months now, and through the end of the year certainly. And so what you've seen is all of these forecasts have been contingent on the war ending. And there's a one from I think Morgan Stanley or Goldman says the Strait will reopen by June 1st because the markets could not handle it if it does not. And June 1st is on Monday. We're looking at 5 days here. This negotiation on an end of the war does not, I don't know, depending on the hour or the minute, does not seem to be taking shape. And so I think we could see some real pressure in the market, physical shortages in the next few days, at least according to the analysts, if things don't break through.
Lastly, I know you've got to run. The sort of like knock-on effects of the inflation. Obviously, we're going to see it through oil. Oil implicates a lot of things, but we're going to start having food issues because of the lack of nitrogen and its implications for fertilizer. We may see also issues in terms of like chips. What can you tell us about what we can expect across the board, and when we're going to start to see the impacts of that from an inflation perspective?
Yeah, so we've already seen the first order impacts, right? We've seen two of the hottest inflation prints that we've seen since 2022, just in the last 2 months. And the next one's going to be hotter. We're seeing the price pressures from energy. They're, of course, directly impacting your gasoline bill. But the thing about oil is it gets turned into diesel. And diesel is what all the trucks that carry all the goods and a lot of the food, about 80% of the food in the U.S. is distributed by truck. And so when those costs go up, that's going to feed through the supply chains down to the consumer as well. And so you see food at home, the category in the CPI report was up past 3% last month. That's expected to get more and more expensive and for that inflation to go up. One, as you see the cost of that diesel diffused through the supply chain, as well as the cost of fertilizer really hitting farmers in the spring planting season. So when they harvest those crops in the fall, they'll get hit with another food shock and cost shock as well. So it's not just oil. It's not just gas. You mentioned semiconductors, too. Again, another industry making a ton of money, but they're bidding up the costs for all of those chips that, as we learned during COVID, go into just about everything. Washing machines, cell phones, anything, basically anything you buy, electronics has a chip in it. So we're seeing those cost pressures continue to increase. And there's some very valuable gases, helium and neon and others, that are also disrupted by the war, too, that are going to start putting cost constraints on companies in the coming months, too. So it's not looking good in the inflation picture right now. We're expecting to see higher inflation for the next several months until, again, the war ends.
I guess one last question. To sort of like add one more element and I guess variable to this, I'm reading a lot about this super El Nino that we may be having this year, which like record-breaking El Nino. Have you seen and been looking at models as to like what happens if this El Nino hits and how it impacts things like superstorms and droughts and whatnot? Like, do you have a sense of what the implications of that are?
Yeah, I mean, again, it depends on the severity. And of course, we've been seeing with the effects of climate change and changing weather patterns, these superstorms getting more and more destructive. But I mean, these are potentially disastrous for crops and for food. What you've just been talking about earlier, predicted to hit California, hit Texas. These are, again, oil-producing states, too. And there's energy infrastructure that could potentially be at risk. We've seen in these kinds of superstorms some of the unintended ramifications of the disaster. There was a quartz mine in North Carolina that during the flooding was taken offline. It's the only quartz mine that supplies high-end semiconductors right now. We see a transformer manufacturing plant get hit by tornadoes in Oklahoma. And so there's real possibilities, one, of course, of the human damage and property damage, but further inflationary pressures by storm damage coming further and more uncertainty, I think, for consumers who are going to be hit by, you know, probably rising energy costs from blackouts, higher food costs from the war, from the storm.
Jeez. Well, sounds great.
I'll do a sunnier one next time.
Are you going to be able to, do you think? Because I don't
know. Might
I,
be
I,
too
I mean,
sunny.
I wouldn't promise something like that. Alex Haquez, Chief Policy and Advocacy at Groundwork Collaborative. Thanks so much for your time today. Much appreciated. We're going to link to your piece on the windfall that big oil has racked up during this. Just the one of many implications of this really useless war that Trump is engaged in. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking about Duss, Executive Vice President, the Center for International Policy, co-host of the Undiplomatic podcast. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the Executive Vice President at the Center for International Policy and co-host of the Undiplomatic podcast, Matt Duss. Matt, thanks for joining us. You just wrote a piece in the Foreign Policy magazine, how the Abraham Accords fueled a new era of conflict and timed it. I don't know if you're in talks with the president about his call for everybody in the region to join if he decides to have peace.
What do you call it? A mandatory request?
A mandatory request.
Amazing.
Tell us, for people who don't know, give us the history of the Abraham Accords. Mm-hmm. And as we talk, too, we're going to bring up the fact that there, right now, of all times, there feels like there is a big push for a dramatic change in the democratic foreign policy machine. But we'll get there, because part of this story is the Biden administration sort of just accepting all of this.
Right. So thank you. Great to see you both, as always. So the Abraham Accords signed in August of 2020, initially an agreement, you know, allegedly, air quotes, brokered by Jared Kushner. As if Jared, I guess, showed up kind of at the last minute to dot some I's and cross some T's. But it was an agreement between the United Arab Emirates and Israel, who had a kind of behind the scenes relationship for some years already. But it was a way for them to bring that relationship out into the open. It was called a peace and normalization agreement, which was somewhat strange, given that the UAE had never actually been at war with Israel. Bahrain quickly joined that, and there was a big, you know, signing ceremony on the White House lawn. Obviously, Donald Trump loves the idea of being a peacemaker, but there were lots of questions about it from the very beginning. Is it actually a peace deal? What is it achieving? It seemed to me and a lot of others that, okay, this is just kind of an agreement for Israel and the United States to be able to sell more weapons to authoritarian regimes like the Emiratis, like the Bahrainis. It creates more markets for Israeli tech, and it creates new wells of capital for those firms as well. You had a number of other countries joining the agreement afterward. The Biden administration, for its part, when it came into office in January 2021, initially held it at sort of arm's length. Their response was, okay, this is kind of interesting. But as they did on many things, eventually they just kind of picked up the ball from Trump and decided to embrace the policy and treat the Accords as a framework for building a new and stable architecture in the Middle East, with the United States still deeply involved. There, the kind of big prize there was seen as Saudi Arabia, the idea that if you get, you know, Saudi and to sign a normalization agreement with Israel, this would be this huge prize that Joe Biden could claim as part of his legacy. But of course, one of the big problems with the agreement from its beginning was that it was clearly an effort to marginalize the Palestinian issue. Benjamin Netanyahu has always argued, going back, you know, decades, that, okay, the Palestinian issue is overblown. People don't really care about it. Israel doesn't need to deal with this issue before it makes peace and builds relationships with the rest of the region. And this agreement did seem to demonstrate his theory of the case, at least as far as the UAE and Bahrain and a few other countries were concerned. But it clearly was not the case with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia had all along made clear and continues to make clear that they cannot move forward with any kind of normalization agreement with Israel unless and until there is real movement on the Palestinian issue, which, of course, this Israeli government is completely unwilling to do at all.
When we had Mohammed Ali Shabani on, he kind of drew a distinction between the Saudi incentives and, say, the incentives of the UAE. One, as the UAE being more of a less interested in territorial integrity and more interested in being a place where Western capital can park its money, and you can have a vacation destination, and all this kind of shady money can flow through the UAE. But Saudi Arabia, obviously much larger country, has a different, I think, incentive structure from their leader, from their leadership. Can you lay that out? And also, even in that context, discuss the rivalry between the UAE and the Saudis.
Yeah, no, this is a really interesting point. So, yes, I mean, Saudi Arabia, first of all, is in a very different place from the UAE. UAE is a very small country. It has made itself a kind of player in the region, in large part because of an alliance with Saudi Arabia. That alliance has cooled significantly over the past few years. If you remember, during the first Trump administration, you had the Saudis and the Emiratis working together essentially to blockade Qatar. Now Qatar has pulled much closer to the Saudis, and the Emiratis are pulling, you know, staying close to Israel. So there are a lot of different moving pieces in the region. But another really key distinction here is that, as you noted, the Emiratis, yes, they want to be a place where Westerners and including Israelis can come for vacation and take lots of selfies on these fancy hotels with like ski slopes indoors. I mean, crazy, you know, crazy stuff. They source basically a laundromat for ill-gotten gains from around the world. That is something they are doing. But they saw the Abraham Accords, among other things, as a way into Washington's good graces, essentially by normalizing their relations with Israel. And this is something that is true for all the countries that have signed on. They understood that the main prize of the Abraham Accords was not a relationship with Israel. The main prize of the Abraham Accords was kind of making themselves a part of Israel's lobbying coalition here in Washington and getting goodies that way. The Saudis, for their part, their calculation is different. The Saudis have historically seen themselves as the key voice for the Arab world and for the Muslim world, given the fact that Saudi Arabia hosts the two most important Muslim holy sites in Mecca and Medina. So they are much more sensitive to the view of their own public and to global Muslim publics and Arab publics around the world about what the view would be if they moved forward to warming relations with Israel while the occupation, the apartheid, and now the genocide were still ongoing.
And isn't it part of it also a key difference is that the UAE has no population?
Yeah.
They have a population, but there's something like 80-90% of the people who live there are not from there, as opposed in Saudi Arabia. Like, they have an Arab population that lives in the region, that was born there, and far more sort of, I would imagine, although it seems, based upon what we've saw in Gaza and the reaction from the Saudis, maybe more disconnected than it has been in 50 years, 75 years, but they're still somewhat connected to the Palestinian people, at least in terms of being of the region and having some type of history, right, within family members and et cetera, et cetera. I would imagine that has to act on domestic pressures.
Yeah, that is right. I mean, for both cultural, historical, political reasons, Saudi Arabia has been much more of a player in this. And as you noted, UAE is relatively small. They've got a small population. It is not, as I said, not a democracy, but by virtue of their enormous energy wealth, they're able to subsidize a pretty decent standard of living for their own very small population, with the understanding of, we're going to take care of you, but don't complain about, the emir and the way he chooses to rule. That's not your business. You've got a lot of guest workers. That's not, a lot of those foreigners that you're talking about are, guest workers from South Asia and East Asia. That's true of the Gulf countries in general. There are a lot of those foreign workers that come to Saudi Arabia as well. But given the very, very small population, the ratios are much, much different in UAE.
I'm also just sort of struck, as we get into the Biden administration, where there's ostensibly experts, right? I mean, Jared Kushner and Witkoff was not there the first time around, but they're just... They're golf buddies, essentially. That's their qualification of being there. But ostensibly, we had experts in the Biden administration.
Yes,
Joe Biden, his entire core brand proposition, at least the way he perceived it, was to be the foreign policy guy. Having sat, chaired the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for, I don't know, decades maybe.
Yeah.
And, how could they forget that the fundamental issue in that region was the relationship between the existence of Israel, the way it came into existence, the way it expanded, and the Palestinian people. Like, how could you ally that? Right. The whole region, it seems to me, essentially
arrogance.
It's shocking.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, arrogance, ideology, you know, Joe Biden, I think his reputation as certainly he believed himself to be a great foreign policy expert, but he was a foreign policy expert from, you know, the late 80s and early 90s. And he's kind of trapped in amber, I think, with that understanding of the region. Anyone who's ever heard him talk about the Middle East or talk about Israel and Palestine has almost certainly heard him talk about his first trip to Israel, where he met with Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir. Like, he cannot stop talking about that meeting. He constantly brings it up. And again, it's like his understanding of the region is trapped in this moment. He's also always been one of these people who really does himself downplay the significance of the Palestinian issue. He had Peter Beinart wrote a really good profile of him on these issues a few years ago. Where there's
this is
this
right before he came in. I remember that, and it became sort of apocryphal. In the sense that it was it ended up being dead on, too dead on in many respects.
Right, too dead on. And there was a line that Joe Biden has reportedly used about the Palestinians. One I find very offensive, as should most people. It is never get yourself crucified on a small cross. The meaning of that was like, you know, if you're going to, you know, don't waste time on these small peripheral issues. And I think that shows how deeply misguided Joe Biden's policy was, how deeply he misunderstood the region, despite his own judgment of himself as an expert. And I think his approach to the region and to this issue in particular reflects that misunderstanding. You know, you also had other people around him like Brett McGurk, someone who himself never really paid much attention to the Israeli-Palestinian issue, was always much closer to the Gulf, played a role in Iraq, but someone who was also kind of politically and ideologically inclined to just downplay the importance of the Palestinian issue. Then you had others around like Jake Sullivan, like Tony Blinken, longtime staffers who just tended to reflect whatever Joe Biden wanted. And I think, you know, we saw when they came in, as I said, they held the Abraham Accords at arm's length. But once Joe Biden decided, hey, I could be the president who gets this big Saudi-Israeli normalization, won't that be amazing? I'll be the first president since Carter to kind of do something like this. And once he decided he wanted that, then his administration spent, in my view, wasted a lot of time trying to achieve that. And what was even more baffling to me is after October 7th, I would have hoped that they would have taken a moment to say, okay, this theory of regional security, the idea that we're going to marginalize the Palestinian issue, has clearly not worked. We need to rethink this. Instead, they just doubled down. Of course, we all saw them do what they do, just backing Israel to the hilt with the devastating years-long assault on Gaza. And they doubled down in support of a normalization agreement between Israel and Saudi Arabia, which in my view was never going to happen even before October 7th, and was super never going to happen after October 7th, because once again, the Saudis have been very, very clear that they cannot do this in the absence of any real, you know, tangible movement toward Palestinian liberation. And this Israeli government is not going to do anything like that.
Can you speak a little bit more about the Biden administration and even the Trump administration, maybe less so, but really the Biden administration's kind of reliance on these large scale peace agreements? I mean, NATO is an obvious example where he kind of tripled down on NATO and the idea that we should be these military alliances are the core base of our foreign policy, versus what we see with China, that they're making these more individualized kind of hybrid agreements with some of these states. And a lot of it has less to do with military defense, more technology sharing and stuff like that. But that seems to be, I think, a real point of demarcation, and it's part of how the United it makes it seem like the U.S. is a declining empire with outdated tactics. Is the U.S. a declining empire with outdated tactics?
I have very bad news, or good news, depending how you feel about empire. but yes, no, I mean, that's right. I mean, it all, I think you can look to this line that Joe Biden was using as soon as he took office: America is back. America is back, baby. We've gotten past this weird little hiccup with that Donald Trump guy, and America is back running the world. We're doing, you know, we're, as you know, whether it's NATO, whether it's AUKUS, this agreement with the UK, with Australia. And this was also the kind of logic that underlay this, you know, effort to build, you know, the Saudi-Israeli normalization. It was a way of using military-to-military relationships. Security and America as ultimately a security guarantor as a way to sustain its role as the global hegemon. This is over. This was already over. I mean, the world is already changing. But again, Joe Biden, I mean, he's not even a man of the post-Cold War. He is a man of the Cold War. This is where his habits of mind were formed. And, you know, you mentioned China, and I think it's important to note, going back to the Middle East for a moment, for some folks in the administration, particularly Jake Sullivan, I think that, you know, China was, you know, we know that for the Biden administration, even though they did spend a lot of time on the Middle East, ultimately China was their focus. They understood.
This is true of the Obama administration too, right? I mean, that's what the whole pivot to Asia thing happened. Mm-hmm. That's what the TPP was about. Yeah. I mean, the whole, we had moved our Navy essentially to the Pacific in the early 2010s.
Well, I think Obama, the pivot to Asia, I think Obama understood that we were well overinvested in the Middle East, and he was correct. But I think it was not until the first Trump administration where we saw, you know, the idea of this great power competition between the U.S. and China really, really starkly being defined as this is the new threat. This is the new defining. This is what will define American foreign policy now and into the future. And again, this is yet another policy area in which the Biden administration simply picked up the ball from the Trump administration and moved forward with it. And so you see the way that the Biden administration approached the Middle East was in part an effort to box China out of the region. Now, this is bizarre because, you know, China has no interest in replacing the United States as the regional security guarantor. Why in the world would they? You know, they've watched the United States trip over itself and bleed resources, time, and attention and credibility in this region for decades. Why would they want a piece of that? And yet, this is this kind of frantic effort, you know, to kind of, you know, to keep China out of the region is what, you know, defined the first Trump administration and even more so the Biden administration.
I can't help but think, well, there's two things. I have another question for you. But as we talk about this, because, you know, we just had Alex Haquez on to talk about the enormous windfall American oil companies are making. Really, I mean, international oil companies that don't deal with the Gulf, and that most of that oil goes to China. But because it's all on the market, the prices increase because of the constrained supply, it increases for everybody. Even if you spend the exact same amount pulling it out of the ground and refining it, but it seems to me that. You know, and I'm sure over the years this has come up when we've spoken. Gary Hart, I interviewed him in 2004, was talking about he and I think it was Rudman were chairing a 21st century threat. And they assembled people around a room. And they went around and everybody, you know, said non-state actors, you know, international terrorism. And one person said China. And everybody sort of laughed. They reconvened like 3 or 4 months later. That same person said China. Everybody sort of laughed. That person never came back. It was Lynn Cheney. And it seems to me that much of what we saw with he convened this back in 2001, right before in the summer before bin Laden attacked. And it seems to me that like Iraq was very much oriented towards our having control of the oil and projecting onto China a need to have a greater presence in the Middle East mm-hmm. because they needed fuel literally to fuel their economic growth, which we were terrified of. Yeah. And now, of course, they have they've maintained the amount of fuel that they need from there and just built alternate energy sources and almost like just did this parallel thing where they just. It's like we're living in a different planet. Right. They just basically left the planet Earth and went somewhere else, essentially.
Right. We helped China become energy independent to a great extent, or at least, you know, massively invest in renewables. Yes.
And we are still operating under this premise that somehow all of the wind and solar that they've built, the sun's going to go away and the wind's going to stop blowing and they're going to need more than, 20% of the world's oil supply, when in fact all they're going to need is a diminishing amount each year, it seems like.
Right. You know, and it's interesting hearing, because I remember, reading about the Hart-Rudman project, because if you remember, again, in the 90s, after the end of the Cold War, the kind of U.S. foreign policy establishment was kind of casting about for what defines us? What's the enemy that defines us? What's it going to be? The Soviet Union's gone, and there was definitely a movement. And Lynn Cheney was not just one voice. She may have been just one voice in that room, but there were definitely folks who were ready, for China to kind of slot in where the Soviet Union had been. If you remember the crisis in Hainan Island, where the crash of the U.S. surveillance plane very early in the George W. Bush administration, things were in play for, then all of a sudden 9/11 happened and everyone's like, whoop, nope, we're slotting terrorism in. We'll get to China later. But this, was kind of simmering just under the surface for a long time.
Yeah, I remember even in the aughts, anti-Chinese political ads that they would just crop up every now and then. We certainly discussed with frustration during the Biden administration their failure to get back into a deal with Iran. And at that time, I just seem to remember befuddlement and... Yes. In retrospect, are you reassessing the Biden administration's failure to get back into that deal rather than just being incompetent, but more not interested? And because of their orientation towards the Abraham Accords and all that implied?
I think that, there's two things. One is there were people, people I mentioned, like Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken, both played major roles in getting that agreement under Obama. But the fact is, Biden clearly was not that invested. He was not invested in two of Obama's most important foreign policy initiatives, the agreement with Iran and the opening with Cuba, both of which he essentially just tanked. Both horrible decisions, because once again, Joe Biden is actually bad at foreign policy. Okay, I think so. I don't know whether it's a reassessment. I think I was very critical and frankly baffled and really pissed off about Biden's decision, first of all, to slow walk the return to the JCPOA. Let's remember, he wrote a piece in October of 2020 laying out pretty unequivocally how he was going to rejoin the Iran.
That's what was so bizarre about it.
And all of a sudden they get into office and they're deciding, they're going to take their time and get a longer and stronger deal. And what are you talking about? You've just been elected. You've got all this political capital to use, rejoin the deal, work out some details later. But instead, they hit the brakes. They felt like, oh no, we have all these hawkish Democrats. We've got to appease and blah, blah, blah. Just, both wrong on the policy and the politics. And again, they waited. And meanwhile, Iran had an election. The team that had negotiated the agreement with Obama was out. A much more hardline team was in. That team had watched the first few months of Biden's presidency and decided quite reasonably, we probably can't trust Joe Biden, given that he was literally elected, having promised to rejoin this deal and then didn't do it. And so that's basically how we lost a really important nonproliferation agreement with Iran and put us on the path to this war right now.
Let's turn to that cadre of foreign policy advisors. In the course of 3 or 4 days, Ben Rhodes has come out with a piece that we need to turn the page on those people. He's been, I think, articulating that for some time. Chris Van Hollen came out with a editorial which both said that we was explicit about changing our foreign policy stance towards Israel, and by implication, those who had fashioned the existing policy that we had under the last Democratic administration. And Brian Schatz, who I am less confident in where he will be from day to day, frankly, on this stuff, But certainly as a bellwether, because mm-hmm. this is a guy who I think has aspirations to lead the right. Democrats in the Senate, also said both Democrats, primary voters won't trust any Democratic presidential candidate who does not have a record of moral and strategic clarity on these issues. He's talking about Israel. Mm-hmm. Especially if, as a legislator, he or she voted to send Netanyahu bombs, even as his government imposed a total blockade on Gaza. Again, they're sort of using the Netanyahu, not Israel hedge, mm-hmm. but whatever. But he goes on to say, and nor will they support any candidate who plans to reenlist senior Democratic decision makers who whitewashed the truth during the Biden administration and refused to acknowledge their complicity.
Yeah.
Like they're speaking specifically about yeah. Jake Sullivan, about yeah. McGurk, others mm-hmm. who were in that cadre and have led us to sort of like this, you know, multi-year disaster. What's your sense about how sort of like real this is?
Yeah, my sense it is very real. I think that is not the first time I've heard that from a member of Congress. That is the first time I've seen it published in that way. It will not be the last. I mean, I think just as you noted, coming from first Schatz and then Van Hollen in a more detailed op-ed. Schatz was a tweet and then Van Hollen as part of that New York Times op-ed. But both two leading Democrats, two relatively young leading Democrats, and Van Hollen in particular, who has been a leader on foreign policy and particularly on the issue of Israel and Palestine. But as I said, this is something that I have heard from members of Congress and from, you know, foreign policy professionals, Democratic, progressive foreign policy professionals all over the place. These people who carried out this policy, and I think what's important about what Van Hollen wrote, it wasn't just that the policy was bad, is that they whitewashed it. They lied about it. This is a point I and others
have
also made.
That was Schatz who said that.
It was Schatz, I'm sorry, who, yes. Well, I think there was something to that effect.
I think Van Hollen said something similar. I mean, I think those actually, they may have both used the exact same words there practically.
Right, and I do think that's really important because, I mean, again, the policy was bad enough. I think what really, you know, makes it, you know, the another offense in addition was the fact that they stood up there at the lectern day after day after day and misled and gaslit and lied about what was happening on the ground, which everyone could see, you know, on their phones all the time. And yet they refused to acknowledge the reality of this genocide.
Yep. Well, I guess hope springs eternal.
It'll be interesting to see how that analysis carries over to Kamala Harris's impending presidential run. That's just one thing I just want to flag here, because she's leading in the polls right now among Democratic primary voters. That doesn't mean anything. But I do think if this is kind of a consensus opinion amongst top Senate Democrats, as they're trying to angle with Schumer likely being, you know, going away, I don't know. Just something to note.
Yep.
Matt Duss, Executive Vice President, the Center for International Policy, co-host of the Undiplomatic podcast, which we will link to. Thanks so much for your time. Always a pleasure. Really appreciate your insights.
Always glad to. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. Before somebody IMs in, I will make a self-correction. I used the word apocryphal. Did not mean to use that word. I used it in the context of Peter Beinart's piece. And what I meant to say was prescient or some version of that.
I can't believe you can catch that in
you
that.
Should have said unilateral.
Nobody IMed about it.
Okay.
Which I found shocking.
I believe you've been prescient.
Nobody I am.
Did he write it or not, Sam?
I don't get what you're saying. Nobody I am about it, but I just, it was bothering me.
Good self-scout.
It was a unilateral editorial by Peter Bonner.
Exactly. Well, I made a unilateral decision to correct myself without any other input. Uday and Kusei Lutnick, I almost did, but didn't want to make you look like a dummy. Incidentally, I think, Sam, I think you meant prophetic. Yes, I could have meant prophetic or prescient. Yes. But the whole point was to avoid this conversation. Folks, you can help support us with what we do here, which is just pedantry and mockingness.
Mm-hmm. Being really mean.
If you want to join us in being the mean girls in
the smug fund.
Yes. Yeah, join the smug club.
Honestly, merch idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Should at least be the smug half.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, no, yeah. Smug club is because Crowder.
Yeah, no, I get it.
Oh, you get it.
Oh, he gets it.
I didn't know if it would precede. You were that in the
he
weeds.
He was being smug.
No, I was a big Steven Crowder fan before.
Oh, back in
Sam,
the day.
Who I want to thank you again for really saving me from the right.
It wasn't until Brian saw me show up for that debate where he's like, wait, why won't Crowder debate him?
I put my gun away.
Everything
forever
I thought.
After that.
Right.
Everything. Yeah, Brian was sitting at his computer with his chest holster.
Yeah.
And he was sitting there going like, why is Crowder running? Has this all been a lie? And he put his gun down.
I canceled my pec implant surgery.
Exactly. It's a video of Michael Jackson with someone's holding a gun and he pushes it down. That was Sam to you.
Yeah, exactly.
No more violence anymore.
Chris Burdick says, apocryphal mistake was a result of your hubris after using Lynn Cheney correctly.
I couldn't tell which one it was.
No, it was Lynn Cheney. It was, you know, the mom.
The mom. There yeah. you go.
It's folks, just,
you have a lot of bravery to attempt it. That's my observation. You still
I, you know what
go
I should
for
do,
it.
You know what I should do is I really should just say Lady Cheney.
Just say the mom. Yeah, the mom or the daughter.
Lady Cheney.
Right.
So that anybody can, it doesn't matter.
Right.
No, Lady Cheney the senior. Not yeah. Lady Cheney the junior.
Either the rhino's wife or the rhino's daughter.
Yeah. All women look the same to me.
Folks, it's your support that can help this show keep on keeping on. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also get the fun half. And you can IM us like all of these people who are just absolutely focused on my admission of using the word apocryphal incorrectly. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, hot chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off, and you can buy the Majority Report blend. Matt, what's happening on the Matt Lekian Media Universe?
It was a brand new left reckoning yesterday. We talked about not only the Trump administration saying that it's a vibe session, but also quantitative liberals that still think Biden got a short shrift by people's attitudes towards the economy, which I would contend are negative for a reason. And we also talked about Jasmine Crockett and, you know, for instance, doing crypto shout-outs and celebrating Hassan Piker being subpoenaed. So dodged a bullet with that one, folks.
She also came out for the challenger, the APAC challenger who unseated Al Green.
Wesley Bell. Oh, yeah. Him. And, yeah.
And Wesley going Bell around thing. For Bell, too, as well.
Embarrassed. Just a true embarrassment, really.
What a waste.
Of weaponized narcissism,
or I would say, fine, weaponized narcissism. But she has some political talent. But it's just like, you know, God.
So there's something rotten in certain rotten. Democratic circles that yeah. leads to, I don't know, something like that.
Folks, see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh no! Oh, no! Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
I just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Can you bring back
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
I'm the alpha males.
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay, I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black. Black Africans are back, back.
Come on.
What?
Come on.
What?
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, 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 pussy.
We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland. It is the fun half. Born Blue, can I get a shofar, please? For my 62nd birthday today, I'm not quite old enough for Medicare, but I am getting a few more discounts, and now I qualify for National Park Senior Pass, but hoping Trump's face won't be on it. Been listening since Air America days and even got my son hooked. Grateful Whoa. For Sam and the whole MR crew every freaking day. Born Blue. This is for you. Happy birthday. Whoa. Wastelander, Ryan Grimm just published an article at DropSite about a farmer from Nebraska. It was not Kowalski. Do you think he's spotlighting Dan Osborne instead of Kowalski because he's sour about being debate-bogged on MR?
Something to ask him.
Yeah. You weren't here for that.
I wasn't. I did see a clip. I saw DropSite said that you guys went really, you know, hard at one another.
Yeah, it got ugly.
Over Marjorie Taylor Greene.
It got pretty ugly. It got pretty ugly. What should we get to here? Ooh. I'm not gonna.
Oh, I mean, 12 and 13 are, I think. Just if we want to do Abdul Al-Sayed dominance.
Oh yeah, this is fantastic. You know, Will Cain is an interesting character because I don't know if I've had such firsthand proximity to someone who completely, like, I know a lot of these people do this. It's just that I've never seen it. With such proximity, is to watch someone completely sort of like for money change their whole persona and their whole belief system as Will Cain. So I always find him sort of fascinating.
So you saw up close what we've seen countless times with Why I Left the Left people.
Yes.
It's just but
he wasn't
flavor.
A lefty. He
right.
was just sort of like a sort of a centrist Republican, you know, like a Bloomberg Republican.
But he has such a nondescript face and affect that he could slot into basically any anchor position, and yet he chose Fox. So that says enough, I think.
That's
about
where he landed. I mean, you know, sometimes you got that mortgage. You got to send your kid to whatever.
Well, they let him do the show out of Dallas.
Oh, is he in Dallas now?
Yep.
Oh, he used to be in New York. I wonder why he moved to Dallas. Maybe it's family. Anyways, here is Abdul El Sayed. He is on with Will Kane. Which one should we start with? 12?
Yeah, let's start with 12. 13 isn't that from this debate. But this is just really expertly done here by Abdul El Sayed, who is by far the strongest candidate in Michigan. And if you have any doubts about his ability to adequately confront Republican talking points, I'd encourage you to check out this debate.
Abolish ICE. Now, what I would like to ask you is, ICE is simply the enforcement mechanism for democratically elected laws of the people. Now, for a party who has talked about the threat to democracy, is it your position that you do not want to see the will of the people, the democratically elected laws, enforced?
First of all, Will, you and I both know that immigration law is not criminal law. Immigration law is civil law. It's like getting a parking ticket. So the idea that we should have a paramilitary force that is weaponized on our streets to enforce civil law seems to me to be a bit over the top, particularly considering the fact that the current president is weaponizing ICE against the idea of the rule of law itself, the idea that they should just be governed simply by Stephen Miller and Donald Trump without any enforcement around basic warrant law or the Constitution itself. That to me is frustrating. Now, I want to pivot just quickly because I do want to ask you, do you pump your own gas?
Well, before we start talking about whether or not I pump my own gas,
I'd like to follow up with your answer.
I appreciate
$185 billion.
I appreciate the interest in having a conversation, Mr. Sayed. But what I would suggest is I'm conducting this interview, and I want to ask you about your positions. My interest today is you are running for Senate. No, excuse me. You are running for Senate in the state of Michigan. What I am curious about, as you conduct a tour,
pause it for 1 second. You know, I love the idea of, like, you're in the state of Michigan. For what possible reason would you be concerned with the price of gas?
Yes. Or immigration, he's trying to say, I think, there also as well, right? I mean, isn't that what he's implicit?
Michigan's also known for the car business in this country. What possible... The price of gas. I mean, the entire state of Michigan, particularly in Detroit, like, there is probably no other place in the country where there was more public transport infrastructure ripped out of the ground than Detroit.
Maybe L.A.,
just in terms of sheer, but like the absolute a necessity for it in Detroit. But so, yeah, go back.
But
I just like the idea, like, you're in Michigan, sir.
I guess none of the people, if he's doing this from Texas, that maybe that's what he's implying. But I guess none of the Fox News anchors based in New York City can have an opinion on any other state. It's ridiculous.
Michigan. What I am curious about, as you conduct a tour targeted at counties that voted for both Joe Biden and President Donald Trump, is exactly how extreme or moderate your positions might be. I'm not running for elected office. So my position on current gas prices is of immaterial to the audience. Your positions as seeking elected office are what's important. And what I would like to figure out is whether or not you believe in the rule of law. It's simply not true that...
By that logic, he shouldn't even have a show then, if his opinion is immaterial.
I find it hard to believe that he is not expressing an opinion on this show.
Right.
I'm just a...
But I think, I mean, ultimately, you know, the idea is that we have spent going on $200 billion on this enforcement of civil law. You look at the pictures out in front of the New Jersey protests in an ICE detention center where they are starving people, feeding them
rotten food,
giving them no health care. And you see ICE vehicles that belong in combat.
It's a question.
The ICE agent who shot Renee Good is back on duty, and this guy wants to tell me about the rule of law. Anytime something happens with one of these thugs, people like Will Kane rush to the camera saying, don't worry about local Democrats wanting to prosecute you for instance, killing somebody. The president, you don't have to face those charges.
Well, does he expand on the gas prices point? Yeah, this is later in the interview. He kind of brings it home here.
A living wage. I want to make sure that they got a union. I want to make sure
I understand those positions.
Drink clean water, but you're not asking me that. And when I asked you about whether or not you actually pump your own gas, you didn't answer the question. because you are so
I pump
far
my own gas. We don't have any other way to do it in Texas. We don't have
right,
any other
so
way to do it.
How much did you
Texas.
Pay for the last time? How much did you pay for your gas last time?
I paid a lot. Gas. Gas prices are up right now, and every American is concerned about that.
And you are not asking me about that.
The question is whether or not Americans believe that war. Okay.
That you keep defending. You keep
we're talking over each other. We're talking over each other consistently. And the reason is because we're having two separate conversations. Now, listen, you and I both.
I want to ask you about stuff that's completely irrelevant and that are only interesting to a very narrow sect of the population that is interested in the culture war and one in which I am supposed to keep them focused on.
Yeah, you want to talk
and
about
you
gas
you want
prices.
To talk about gas prices and food prices and whether we're fighting a war and whether we're sending RoboCop to your neighborhood to arrest your gardener, and that's just ridiculous, sir.
Yep. And he also he answered the question about him believing that ICE should be abolished because we shouldn't have a paramilitary force to enforce civil law. And Kane is trying to stay on it. He just doesn't like that El Sayed is bringing him into the waters that are a little more treacherous for the Republicans.
All right, just go back a little bit.
Consistently, and the reason is because we're having two separate conversations. Now, listen, you and I both know, and I'll tell the audience, I know your positions, and I've helped you forward some of those positions. I know you're opposed to the war in Iran. I know you're for Medicare for all. But you have other questions you have to answer. Last week, you and I texted, and you are still going to have an invitation on this show to have these long conversations. There'll be many people in the watching audience who do not appreciate that. But I think both the people who could vote for you, support you, and oppose to you need to understand where you are in deeper positions. And you have given plenty of reason for people to understand and question those things. I don't think you've answered those directly today, but I'm always willing to continue to have that conversation with you.
Is that how he ended it? Just filibustering about and lecturing to him because he knew it wasn't going well for him?
It's my party and I'll cry if I want to.
Yeah.
You are shifty, and I wanted people to know that you're evasive and shifty.
I'm trying to talk about the immigrants under the bed, sir.
Are you aware that there's a caravan forming right now in the Andes? No. Should we play number 13 or? Oh, let's play 11.
Okay.
Since we're talking about this, I found this so enraging. Let me just preface this before we get into this. In the early teens in this state, maybe even the late aughts, Democrats controlled the Senate and the House in New York State. And in the Senate, despite the fact that Democrats controlled, they could never get legislation to Andrew Cuomo's desk that was progressive because there was a group of, I think, about five or six maybe state senators who were a member of the IDC, the Independent Democratic Caucus. And what they would do is they would vote with Republicans all the time to kill progressive legislation. And it became clear that it was Andrew Cuomo who had orchestrated this caucus as a way to prevent progressive legislation coming to his desk so that he didn't have to veto it because he had dreams of being a presidential candidate and thought the way you do that is to come from New York having no record of actually doing any progressive legislation, but having the progressive bona fides. And it wasn't until Cynthia Nixon ran against him that the IDC became more publicized. And voters realize that they're you know, because who pays attention to their state senators? Not a lot up until, really in the teens when it became the focus. Then they voted them out. And then we had a whole rash of progressive legislation, et cetera, et cetera. Well, one of Andrew Cuomo's top aides who orchestrated that was a woman named Melissa DeRosa. And oh, here she is.
No, absolutely. I mean, the main race really demonstrates the civil war that's happening within the Democratic Party. And there are a lot of Democrats, moderate Democrats like myself, who will not cry tears should we lose Maine. I mean, that would be a pickup to begin with. But
oh, because you would rather see, she's admitting there, like the IDC, interestingly, have somebody who functions as a Republican in that Senate seat and not a Democrat like Plattner. You know, it's because Melissa DeRosa is so moral. You know, she stands up for what's right, and she just can't get past the Nazi tattoo. As an aside, Melissa DeRosa is often described as Cuomo's enforcer. When Andrew Cuomo was accused of sexual harassment and inappropriate touching by many women, I don't know if there was a staffer that was more integral in making sure that their claims and their experiences were not heard and were not investigated than Melissa DeRosa herself. There was a report that was issued about Andrew Cuomo's sexual misconduct. She's mentioned over 180 times in the report, is frequently spoken about as somebody who was aggressive in suppressing the harassment allegations against him, including against Lindsay Boylan herself. So Melissa DeRosa just has the best morals, and she can't stand to see Graham Plattner with the Totenkopf covered up, sullying the good name of the United States Senate.
Yeah, I'm so upset about this tattoo. Let me support more bombs for Israel, please, because I'm worried about extremism. It's a joke. All these people are jokes.
She may be a joke, but you have to hand it to her. I mean, think of the competence involved in taking someone who had the name Cuomo. They literally have bridges named after this man, after Cuomo in this state. Two-term governor, somehow botched the whole thing enough so that they sucked up all of this right-wing money. I don't know if there was like a dollar left in the Hamptons for political donations when Melissa DeRosa was done. And they lost, like, not just once during the primary, but twice.
Yeah,
they found their way for a Democratic candidate to lose twice in one election cycle. That is impressive. And if she is Cuomo's enforcer, how about you get off your ass and enforce his promise to move down to Florida?
Exactly.
And start running your operation down in Florida.
What a woman. What a woman to be that kind of woman, and that is her role, is to make sure that the younger women that tried to get ahead with Cuomo himself, potentially like how she did in politics, who were taken advantage of, to make sure that they are silenced and smeared. But let's listen to this just random moderate Democrat. I love how she describes herself as moderate, too. And all of this, we talked about how conservatives project all the time. These are like centrist Republican-light Democrats who projected for years about how the left was going to sabotage these elections and aren't true Democrats that vote against Republicans. Listen to this trickle out with Auchincloss and then having to walk that back, and Melissa DeRosa and all of these other people. They're saying they will not support Plattner against Susan Collins, mm-hmm. who the Democratic Party's tried to fundraise about unseating again, you know, fundraise over unseating her over and over and over again from a national perspective. You have all of these figures saying, we'd rather have Susan Collins in that seat than have somebody who actually stands up to Israel's genocide, wants to tax the rich and more. They've
always been the actual pillar undermining this party and not the left that they constantly attack.
But it's helpful now that everybody that was like a Democrat and voted and understood that it's a defensive vote, and there are a lot of Democrats that hate Republicans and want to vote against them. And like, I do think Nina Turner, for example, in her race, the fact that she had said that she was supporting Jill Stein, that really hurt her when there was energy on her side. Unfortunately, Democratic voters, you know, care about that kind of thing, and they really hate Republicans, probably even more than they like Democrats. But if the moderates...
Without a doubt. That's the polling explicitly says that right now.
I didn't want to be declarative, but it's just like, that's my assessment of it, and the polling, I think, right now is accurate. It's just really helpful, I think, from a propaganda perspective, to rightly have the finger pointed at the centrist corporatists, who are the ones that would rather have Republicans win than the left that's actually fighting right now.
I mean, name a single progressive leader in the Democratic Party who has so explicitly refused to endorse a nominee. But I can name off the top of my head people who refuse to endorse Mamdani. I can name off the top of my head people who are going to refuse to endorse Plattner.
The leader of the Democrats in the Senate. The leader of the Democrats in the Senate refused to endorse Mamdani in the city that he lives in and saunters around Park Slope.
The Democratic nominee for his mayorship.
Meanwhile, AOC will get hammered for the rest of her life about endorsing Kamala.
Exactly. Exactly.
It is stunning. And remember, when you say, I'm not going to cry a tear if Susan Collins wins, what you are saying is unequivocally, I don't care if the Democrats control the Senate. Because there is absolutely 100% no way for the Democrats to control the Senate without winning Maine. It's just not going to happen.
It's the most important flip.
You've got Maine, you've got Alaska, you've got North Carolina.
Texas, maybe.
And then after that, Ohio, maybe. Texas, maybe. Nebraska, maybe. But if you don't get North Carolina, Alaska, and Maine, you ain't getting those other ones. That's just the way, that's just the numbers. That's just the way it's going to work. It's not like they're contingent upon it. It's just like the nature of those states. If they don't flip blue, then it's not going to happen in other places. So it's just absurd. Socialist accountant, Sam, I would not compare RoboCop to ICE. You're thinking of the ED-209, which was clumsy and had a shoot first mentality.
Oh, brother.
Fair. I probably deserve that. Thazzle, could I get a shofar for my wife and her coworkers at Dark Horse Comics for announcing their plan for unionization this morning? Sweet. Michigan basically falls entirely in the 100-mile CBP zone where warrantless vehicle searches are legal. Social Democrat Detroit paid $75 to fill up my car last week. Gas prices affect us, too. Drawn Nathan. Lost signal on the subway right in the middle of Sam's sentence. Jasmine Crackett Moore came out in support of the Challenger. What was the rest of that sentence? I hope it wasn't NASA related. No, it was the Challenger to Al Green, backed by AIPAC.
And crypto, which might be the real through line with the Crockett.
Yeah. Speaking of AIPAC, here's Josh Shapiro. Having pizza, just like a regular guy.
I don't know why that pizza bothered me so much.
It's a pizza in my dark kitchen.
I wanted to flip the table over when I watched this video.
Do you think Politico brought the pizza, or do you think Josh 100%. Shapiro brought the pizza to look like he was a man of the people?
I think it's probably, I think you're right.
You think he did?
I think his people were like, we need him in front of a pizza. He's too buttoned up.
And maybe tone down the Obama impression like 30%.
It is amazing how much Josh Shapiro's stock has fallen. It is hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
But here he is talking about again, like, this is over. This is what I find fascinating about this conversation. It's over. You have lost this conversation. And, you know, I mean, I guess kudos for being such a diehard,
right.
But really indicative of a completely tone-deaf political radar.
Shocked that this guy volunteered for the IDF.
...lines in your party. We saw it play out in this primary here in Philadelphia, in which AIPAC, which historically was a bipartisan group that supported pro-Israel candidates, came in and helped the candidate who wound up coming in third place, I think, and lost. Has AIPAC now become, in a Democratic primary at least, an anchor around some of these candidates, something to be avoided?
Yeah, I don't know. And look, it's never been an issue in any of my races.
Pause it for one second. I'm sorry, I'm going to jump in here, because unless you are completely blind, deaf, and dumb, it is 100%, without a doubt, unequivocally, regardless of what you think about AIPAC, not just an anchor around a candidate, it's a burning tire. Like, they are going three levels deep to hide their involvement in these races. And when it gets exposed,
yeah,
these people are toast.
Yeah.
They are toast the next day. It is an anchor.
Why would AIPAC be hiding it through these shadow PACs that keep cropping up, and they're creating new ones in every single district that they're running in if this wasn't a political issue for them? I mean, it's just made up that...
It's so blinkered. Of course it is. I mean, it's like, and here's what's amazing about this. Who watches this Politico shit?
Yeah, I know.
Honestly, it's just people like us. It's like, there's nobody unsavvy enough to be watching this who wouldn't know the moment he opens his mouth, he's not lying, unless this is like made for three people,
yes,
who are AIPAC donors who are like, see?
It's like the allegory of the wine cave, because it's like actually literally they are speaking just to wealthy people here, and they have no idea what they're looking at. They're just looking at shadows.
I don't even know why they put it on. They should just why put it on X? Why not just do
an exclusive
a direct pay-per-view, like a Bloomberg terminal? Yeah.
Political Plus.
Go ahead.
Political Plus.
That's something to be avoided.
Yeah, I don't know. And look, it's never been an issue in any of my races at the state level. But I do think it has cynically been used by some. I'm going to make this a broad statement, not about the race here in Philly. But I think it's been used cynically by some to try and silence certain voices, to try and say that certain people participating in politics shouldn't count or should be viewed in a toxic way. Now, do I agree with every political decision they've made, every endorsement they made? Of course not.
Have they hurt themselves, do you think, AIPAC?
But I think what we have seen is a weaponization of that. And I think that is a danger for our system. When you have people who are advocating for issues that they feel strongly about, and they are having their voices silenced, I think that's a problem in our system.
There's a blurring between
being... Can you pause it? This is a Democrat who is making the conservative argument that won the Citizens United case. He's making the right-wing argument that money is speech, and any encumbrance upon that is a violation of the First Amendment rights to spend in an unlimited manner in elections. And he is making that case to defend the funders of the genocide that are trying to buy off assets in our government to continue a genocide. He's making that argument.
It's worse because there's no legal encumbrances whatsoever to AIPAC getting money. What he has a problem with is the fact that people are saying this money is bad to play in is really wrong. Like, who is it that he thinks he's being silenced? AIPAC, there have been, if you look at the three most expensive races in the history of Congress, they are Jamal Bowman's, they are Cori Bush's, and they are Thomas Massie's. And they are all the most expensive congressional races in the history of America,
yep,
because of AIPAC spending, where they won in each one of those races.
So
and so the idea that there's somebody saying, like, it's being weaponized and they're not being, their voices are trying to be silenced. There is no louder voice. It's just that he is upset because people are ignoring that voice.
Yeah.
They're not listening to that voice. But that voice is not being silenced. That voice is like we're talking LRAD level of how loud that voice is.
They're blasting it on the speakers because that when you equate money as speech, you know what happens? The more money you have, the more speech you have. So no one is buying this thing where you're hiding behind your like this vague notion of anti-Semitism in this race. We've all been able to disaggregate that Zionism is different than Judaism. And we all know that this is a Republican front group. And every voter knows that at this point as well. And that's what scares him.
I haven't interviewed many politicians, a few here or there. And I know that if you throw them up a follow-up that's easier to answer than the question they are answering, they will go to that follow-up and stop answering the one they are. Where this guy, the Axios guy, or political guy, asks him this question, did AIPAC do anything to make it worse on themselves? He hears that question and then decides, that's not the avenue I want to go down.
In a toxic way. Now, do I agree with every political decision they've made, every endorsement they made? Of course not.
Have they hurt themselves, do you think, AIPAC?
But I think what we have seen is a weaponization of that. And I think that is a danger for our system. When you have people who are advocating for issues that they feel strongly about, and they are having their voices silenced, I think that's a problem in our system.
There's a blurring between being against AIPAC and being against Jewish folks giving money yourself.
No, there's not.
I think it does get blurred, because now what you are seeing is not, you know, quote unquote AIPAC money or however it was termed, but you're getting the Jews who give to that candidate who also support AIPAC. I think it's very dangerous in our system. If you are trying to silence certain voices.
This is him. He's whining. He's whining that the donors to AIPAC, some of them who happen to be Jewish, now have to go around the organization and donate in a different manner because the AIPAC organization itself has been toxic. And he's equating that to silencing them.
I just happen to like McMorrow. It's not, it has nothing to do with my previous, you know, $2,000 donation to AIPAC. It's just a complete coincidence. And actually, it's actually bad to even mention it.
I give a pass to any Gentile who donates to AIPAC. That's okay. I just don't want to see any Jews doing it.
But I mean, God, I do want to silence Miriam Adelson. I do. I want to silence her ability to buy off a bunch of different races. I hope that Josh Shapiro doesn't say that I'm an anti-Semite, because I don't want this casino billionaire genocidal freak who was Trump's top donor to also be buying off Democratic elections as well. God.
I mean,
silencing women. I have to take a stand here.
You talk about cynicism in politics, and I'm sorry, like Latimer beating Bowman and Bell beating Bush is the height of cynicism to me. And that cynicism was bought by money, donor money. And that, those donors are going to be held accountable.
Gentile money that went to AIPAC.
This story is really like the hybrid of things that really get put a bee in my bonnet, your favorite phrase, Brian. It's corruption and the Citizens United stuff and the explosion of dark money. And it's the kind of complete the Zionism and cynical usage of real exploding anti-Semitism to hide the fact that you are too much of a pro-genocide, corrupt politician to stand on your own two feet and build a constituency without money. And so all your donor friends are upset that they're being silenced, and you get to be a voice for that on Politico, which three people are watching.
We should also say, let's just play a little bit more of this.
Yes, let's do this. Let's hear from this brilliant man.
If you are trying to silence certain voices based on their race, based on their faith, based on their particular ideology,
would you want their money, and they be, to be clear, AIPAC donors?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm running for governor, and they don't play in state races. I'm not trying to be cute about that, but it's just not an issue.
That's really cute.
Here in my race for governor.
But this could be a factor down the road if other opportunities do present themselves, right?
Well, I'm not looking down the road. I'm looking at how we can win a re-election for governor, how I can help deliver four U.S. House seats, and how I can finally flip our state Senate, which has been in Republican control since 1992. That's what I'm focused on.
I can't wait till he's on that crowded-ass debate stage, and you're going to have another Jewish candidate up there that's going to be able to say, I didn't take the blood money that you took. How dare you weaponize our Judaism against people that actually are supporting of the end of slaughtering of children here. Anyway, not a fan.
What?
Yeah, not a fan.
Oh. You have done a very good job of keeping that under that bee under your bonnet.
It's so smarmy, too.
He is the smarmiest.
Like, I appreciate almost John Fetterman's grunts more than I appreciate the way that you can be loquacious as you defend your horrific, brutal policy. There's no difference between these two individuals.
I am somewhat relevant. We had mentioned yesterday there was a vote at the Park Slope Food Co-op. In terms of essentially boycotting Israeli products. This has been a 15-year debate at the Park Slope Co-op. Dead name Drumpf. I took part in the Park Slope Food Co-op meeting and vote last night. My understanding is that of the 16,000 or so members, about 7,000 or 8,000 participated. That's just me editorializing here. It was great to see such strong support for the boycott against Israeli goods. The measure passed 67-31%. Those running the event couldn't believe the turnout, around 7,000, I believe, which is extraordinary. people are voting in the and 67% is important because if I remember correctly, I was a former member, that when this last came up, there was a procedural vote that said boycotts need to achieve 2/3 majority. No other.
Yeah.
But be that as it may, they hit the 2/3. And I got news for you.
Like it's a constitutional amendment.
Shapiro. I got news for Josh Shapiro. I would be willing to bet that there was more Jews who voted for the boycott.
At the Park Slope Co-op? Yeah, yes. Right. Yes, I would imagine that.
There's a decent amount of Jewish people who are members of the co-op. It's my guess.
That would be my guess as well. Okay. The Josh Shapiro thing, too, is also just I had one more point about this. It was driving me insane. Oh, this is the other thing. Okay. I'm still stewing about this. The Kentucky race, right? We called this out. Marjorie Taylor Greene was saying that it was Jewish donors that were donating to Thomas Massie's opponent. And she kept saying Jewish donors over and over again. Now, I got into a short back and forth with Glenn Greenwald over this, saying that she should be talking about Zionism and not Jewish donors because it erases Kufi and the defense industry and the lobby that has been behind the state of Israel for decades at this point. That is coming from the right. So when he's talking about AIPAC and the criticism about AIPAC, it's disproportionately coming from the left in these primaries. The Massie race is a bit of an outlier in these instances. None of the anti-Semitism that he's talking about, where people are saying AIPAC equals Jews, a great majority of it is not coming from the left. And yet they still insist that they have to make this the overemphasis, and he pretends like this isn't setting him up for some sort of 2028 run. I want to see him smoked on the debate stage.
Yeah. I mean, people like Shapiro fundamentally can't be honest about that because they're using it as raw material for their political purposes.
Paco, Pennsylvania comrade, that's what it is. Please talk about this. My city of 10,000 in Columbia, Pennsylvania, just forced our council to vote no on the $6.3 million bid for a data center to be built. Right. Sweet.
That's good to hear.
Let's see. Oh, let's do number 9. Or should we do, let's do 6 and 7.
Okay.
Inside out game, a little bit, with the protests here in New Jersey. AP just did a report showing, rampant suicide in these detention centers because they're so horrific. All sorts of report in California that you've got detention detainees, as it were, in these concentration camps, not getting food, not getting medical care by design. Here's Senator Andy Kim talking to Jake Tapper last night on the squalid conditions at the Delaney
Court
Hall detention center out in New Jersey.
And this is in Newark. And I just want to point out that Cory Booker was not out there. Andy Kim was the junior senator. Cory Booker, who was the mayor of Newark, he tweeted something, didn't mention ICE once in his long scroll. And Andy Kim, to his credit, doesn't have a perfect voting record, but stood on the line there.
And got maced in his eyes.
Pepper sprayed, yeah.
Pepper sprayed.
There is a hunger strike and a broader protest that's happening both amongst the women and the men inside. I went on Saturday. I was actually able to go in yesterday. They initially denied me, but I had to actually call Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen personally to be able to gain entry. And I continue to hear of the poor conditions. I mean, I heard from a woman who's pregnant, who's saying that she's not able to get medical care. Yesterday, I talked to a man that has stage 3 lung cancer that's not getting the medical care that he needs. A detainee handed me a carton of milk. And I looked at it, and it was just congealed solid. I mean, it was absolutely disgusting. But beyond just the conditions, they were also saying they're not able to get their day in court. You know, many of them have been stuck there 8 months, 10 months, 12 months at the cost to the American people. And they showed me this document that shows that today, this Tuesday, that one judge had 74 cases before them in court. I mean, it shows just how broken and how much of a farce of a system it is when they get no more than 5 minutes maximum to be able to really make their case. There is a hunger strike.
Should we hear from the Michigan Fist?
Yes. He's going to be strong. He's shown that he has the intestinal fortitude to stand for long periods and not go to the bathroom, at least not make it visible that you're going to the bathroom for standing in the place in 24 hours. And yet he couldn't bring himself to his home city to stand in front of the detention center.
Well, he set a record for the longest speech in Congress delivered by an apartheid supporter. So
this is tweeted this last night. I'll read it. In the voice of Senator.
You're very concerned.
What happened outside Delaney Hall yesterday was deeply disturbing and completely unacceptable. It reflects the chaos, cruelty, vast erosion for basic democratic norms that have become central to Donald Trump's immigration agenda.
Wow, you are speaking with a lot of force right now.
I am.
What are you saying?
I'm typing. Delaney Hall itself is a moral assault on our state. It should close. It should have never opened in the first place. A private for-profit detention facility should never be allowed to profit from the pain, fear of vulnerable human beings.
Wow.
Reports from detainees, advocates, faith leaders, families describe conditions that demand urgent scrutiny, including concerns about medical care, food, retaliation against detainees. The treat I can't keep on.
Yeah, but the addition of the hand waving, I think, really took it to another level.
People who pose no threat to public safety.
I want the Michigan Fist.
I really got that down, I think. We cannot allow fear, intimidate. Okay, I mean, it just goes on. It's very flowery.
But no ICE, no DHS mention. But I mean, the best is the next
Michigan Fist.
Scroll down. The best comment is right after it. One way street with this limp dick shit booker can't even name ICE in the post.
I will take a little credit for that because I was pretty quick on the draw to respond to Booker's statement on Twitter. And people, you know, seem to like my tweets. So you can follow me at Emma Viglin. Not that it matters anymore.
Is that you?
You said limp dick shit?
Go to the top quotes.
Mezcal Worm is probably Emma's alt.
No, I'm view quotes. View quotes. Go. I'm the top tweet. That's what I'm telling you. Yeah, I know, what? Oh, okay. There we go. It's a little self-aggrandizing. I didn't need to do this, but.
I want that Michigan Fist!
You're on a roll, Knicks, and then this.
Oh, yeah, baby. Cory Booker doesn't know anything about the Knicks because he wouldn't involve himself in any other state except
as a guy who is
Pennsylvania,
focusing so much of my effort on ending human suffering on the planet Earth.
The passive language of that statement, which also looked like it might have been written by AI, was really, really, really annoying.
Only 17%. I put it into a checker, so probably not a high AI thing, but
okay.
I did have the same instinct.
Here is a demonstration outside of Delaney Hall, and you got Fox News there fishing around for protesters, and she is... This is how a Fox News correspondent makes their bones. Go out and talk about how rude the protesters are. Protesters are rude, protesting the literal, torture of some of these people.
And so the other situation is there's people like this. You are a protester who's been out here, and you have a dirty mouth. But, okay, so that's just what we deal with. So just for people that want to know what it's like to cover these protests, it's constant with this. This is what these people do. They want people who are in this country illegally to be released out onto the streets. DHS says that's what they're going to not be doing. So we'll see.
Nazi bitch. That's what
you're Yeah, I mean...
Dirty mouth?
She's right.
We report, you decide. That's what's going on there.
That's that Jillian Michaels shit again, too, where it's just like, I don't like your filthy mouth. Oh, those ICE agents were so polite to me.
First of all, she comes over, she puts her hand on this protester's shoulder. Yeah. Like, hold him here, hold you here.
Yeah. Yeah. They hate poor language. That's why they support Donald Trump.
Here is Joe Scarborough, of all people. When Joe Scarborough says that you have a problem treating human beings, you know you have a problem.
100 men jammed into one room, no guards that will actually come in there. They're sharing maybe one or two filthy backed up toilets. It's unbelievable. But Mika, I was getting to the point that you just made, which is a lot of people will say stupidly, oh, they're illegal. They get what they deserve. First of all, you don't know if they're here illegally. Secondly, the rules keep changing. Now we're going after people applying for green cards and saying now they have to be sent home. People that are in the application process. But I know the Constitution doesn't mean much to you if you are in the cult. I know it doesn't, because you've proven time and again the United States Constitution and constitutional norms don't matter to you. But none other than Antonin Scalia was asked the question, who does the United States apply to? And Scalia said, well, it applies to American citizens living in the United States. It applies to American citizens living all across the world. And Scalia, the godfather of conservative jurisprudence, said, and it applies to anybody that is in the United States of America. They are protected by constitutional rights.
All right. Well,
those constitutional rights are being just...
Okay. The idea that Scalia wouldn't be rubber stamping everything this administration is doing seems insane to me.
Of course he would be. But before this administration, this neo-Nazi was absolutely clear.
Yes.
That the Constitution applies to people who are in the country. That's it. I mean, the Constitution is not a constraint. It does not give rights to individuals. The Constitution constrains the state. That is what all of the conservatives will say. And so it is the obligation of the United States to provide Fourth Amendment protections, to provide habeas corpus, to provide a day in court. That is an obligation on the United States. It is not something that is like bestowed upon the individual because they're American.
Yes. I thought it was, before he went on that rant about Scalia, pretty good and pretty interesting, and should be pretty easy for Democrats to make a case about the inhumanity of ICE if you can have this former Republican, you know, mansplaining to his wife about it on national TV.
I want that Michigan fist!
Glad that was isolated.
This is, that's R.M. Brown. I was just going to go to town. Let's play number nine. I found this sort of interesting. Mark Wayne Mullen, arguably one of the stupidest people in our government. I think there's others, but he's really up there. And he has, and I don't know if they're going to do this. I really hope they do, because I want to see what happens. And I hope they should impose this on all, incidentally, on private jets as well.
Yeah, I'm sure they will.
Yeah. Billionaires literally do not go through customs.
Right.
They just walk off their planes. That's it. They don't go through customs. But here is Mark Wayne Mullen threatening to make international airports in blue cities essentially no longer be international. Good effing luck.
Good thing there's no such thing as connections.
That will last. That will last about 5 minutes. Once a bunch of like business people go like, wait, what?
Do you know where the blue cities are?
I'm sorry. Excuse me. Are you saying that I got to go? I got to fly down to Memphis to do what? Good.
Especially the fact that local law enforcement wouldn't respond. And so I visited with the White House today, Sean, and I said, you know, if they're going to not allow us to go out and arrest the worst of the worst, and then when we call for assistance at the facilities, that the street, it belongs to the city. If it belonged to us, we would take care of it, but it belongs to the city, and they're barricading our employees from coming in and out of the facility, then why are we processing international flights into the airport there? And we are currently, which we're not initiating yet, but we're currently drawing up plans to say, listen, in these sanctuary cities where the local radical left Democrats aren't allowing us to do our job and enforce federal laws, then we shouldn't be processing international flights into their cities either, because they don't want us to enforce immigration, but they want us to process immigration at their facilities. Nothing about that makes sense to me.
Let me tell you something. They're aiding and abetting law breaking, and
when is Hannity going to be wearing an ascot? Let me tell you something. You know what they? You know how they responded when Mullen came to the White House and suggested this to people? They all just went like this. And as soon as he walked out of the room, like, man, that guy is one dumb mother. I mean, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Does he think we could do that for 5 minutes? No international flights into JFK or into Newark?
Yeah, hey, airlines, you're not dealing with any issues right now with jet fuel or, like, you know, anything like that as Spirit Airlines goes under. Why don't you – you're responsible now for redirecting all of these flights into Miami or Memphis or Atlanta or something like that instead of New York City.
I mean, how blinkered do you have – the one thing that ends government shutdowns – the one thing that ends government shutdowns is lines in the airport.
Oh, and I got to tell you, it was pretty rough when I was traveling this weekend, and I was going to, like, you know, northern Florida, had to take some connections, and I think domestic air travel is, like,
oh, domestic
right now,
air travel is a crap show because they're canceling so many flights, because if it's not completely overbooked, they're not going to fly because it's too expensive with the jet fuel. But the idea that you would make international businessmen, and I do mean businessmen, and I do mean, who go from this country to wherever, the idea that you would make them take a connecting flight down to
Fort Worth.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm looking Miami. At the cities that are controlled by Republicans, like, I mean, I'm sorry, guys. Good luck with this. You got Dallas here. You've got Fort Worth. Okay, yeah. That's
I'm going
the two same
to,
ones. Like, Oklahoma City, that's lovely. Can't wait.
How is that going to work? Is there a direct flight from Dallas to London? There may be, right? But
I'm sure
there is. But, like, you're going to go from New York to Dallas to London?
Right.
Get the F out. Like, it's such a stupid an idea. I honestly would like to set up a movement to encourage Mark Wayne Mullen to do this.
Yeah. Right.
This would be one of the
But do you think that's the case? Do you think that all these Trump administration people are like, that's your idea? Why don't you go out on TV and suggest it? Like, I just think that we can't underestimate how much they're rooting against the other person in the cabinet.
That's absolutely true. There could be people in who are at DHS who are like, yeah, good idea.
Yeah, great idea, Marky.
Director Mark.
Right.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
You should bounce that off of Sean Hannity.
Right.
So that the president hears it. Mark, he's an idiot, but he's my idiot.
I like idiots and losers.
What's a connecting flight?
He makes me feel smart. That's why I like him.
Going to fly into Aurora and take a car in because I don't like the radical leftists that control Denver.
Should we play this, Megyn Kelly?
Up to you.
I got to leave after this. You're going to have to land this one. Dawn lights on Marblehead in this clip. You'll remember Megyn Kelly. She was the one who Donald Trump said is bleeding out of every orifice because she was asking him a difficult question.
Mm-hmm.
I think about sexual violence. Was that what she was asking him about?
Yeah.
It was maybe about also Rosie O'Donnell and his other past sexist comments. This might have been after grab him by the P word. And then after that, Me Too happened. Megyn Kelly rode that train. She She spoke about her experience, horrible experience with Roger Ailes, leveraged that into a position at the Today Show until everyone was reminded, oh, wait, this woman's a total psycho racist that's obsessed with Santa's skin color and isn't really a good fit for morning television where Hoda is like drinking wine and telling you which pumpkin you should dress your chihuahua up as. So she's back to her roots of sucking off, well, metaphorically, more powerful men. I actually didn't mean to make it like that joke. I didn't mean to make a sexist joke, but at the very least, she's back to supporting the Republicans.
And she's on the Hodge Twins program.
Who you may not remember.
I do not remember them.
I don't think you need to.
They're hilarious conservative online comedian guys that have been around for now 15 years.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very exciting stuff.
I have to be honest, I didn't expect the corruption to be quite as, you know, widespread as it's been, and like the self-dealing and the lining of his and his family's pockets. Like, that's been a little shocking.
Talking billions of dollars.
And I just didn't expect Trump to be so disrespectful of his base.
Right. Right.
Well, you pause it for a second. You remember that guy who said, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and they would still support me. Yeah. How could you have ever expected that guy to be disrespectful?
Coming,
yeah. I mean, the amount of disdain this guy has for his base.
Yeah. There's a famous Matt Chrisman tweet I'm going to try to find about exactly that. Like, he hates these people more than like libs do.
Yes.
Bread as it's been, and like the self-dealing and the lining of his and his family's pockets. Like, that's been a little shocking.
Talking
and
billions
I just didn't
of dollars.
Expect Trump to be so disrespectful of his base.
Right. Right.
Well, you know what, Megan? I got to push back a little bit because you know Trump didn't take a salary while he's president. So I don't know what you're talking about.
Right. I mean, you look at like across the board of the Trump family, and I've never seen a family get so rich off of a presidency.
Right. Right.
And it happened at the same time as we now have a Supreme Court ruling that basically says any official act he takes while in the White House is protected.
Right.
And those two things are, you know, seem to be giving him some sort of a hall pass that could very much get abused. I don't want to, you know, say he's crossed the line legally because I actually haven't taken a close look at that. But, you know, he's done a lot that pushes it right up to the line. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think we want our presidents or their families getting rich off of the presidency. And I really want to know more about all these trades that are happening on Iran right before he makes the announcements. Like, this is not the way it's supposed to be. This, even one of those would have caused a massive scandal 12, 13 years ago. You know, we shouldn't be so far afield that, like, these obvious ethical questions get skirted past with just a shoulder shrug, because it does matter.
Yeah.
You know, aside from, like, she hasn't looked into it, so she doesn't know if it's legal, but she knows it goes right up to the line. I don't know how you do that. I think you just basically, if you're not going to pay attention to it, you just don't make any proclamations about
like she's protecting something.
But also, the idea that after the first 4 years of the Trump administration, it didn't occur to her that might be some of this. I'm sorry. Unless Megyn Kelly we just saw is an imposter, or the Megyn Kelly that's been here for the past 10 years is an imposter, something's not lining up here. Like, the idea that she's this surprised.
Yeah.
I thought there would be so. I thought they would make $1 billion, but not $4 billion in a year.
Such a liar.
Like, I mean, honestly, she had not heard of Jared Kushner's dealing with the Saudis. Lying. Honestly, it is.
Well, it's a convenient way.
Naked.
It's a convenient way and good. And again, I bring it back to like the Democrats making it about Trump personally and not the broader Republican Party means that, like, I guess 5 years later, this is what the conservative arguments are going to be so that they can push the eject button to get off of this train. She's just making it about him personally, and then she'll support Tucker Carlson or Marco Rubio or whoever for president, and it will change nothing. But she'll make money and get some credibility with some Trump critics in the process. It's our job to make sure she doesn't get that credibility and remind everybody about what this actual, you know, communicator of politics really believes.
That's what this bullshit about Tucker and Marjorie Taylor Greene and whatnot. Look, I am all for them going on their own platforms and saying stuff that I agree with. But the idea that, like, you're going to give them any credibility, because A, my giving them credibility or you giving them credibility does not help them in the mission that you think that they're on. If you think they're on this mission to convert their listeners, you giving them credibility does not help them.
Yep.
2 months
ago. You giving them credibility only helps them with your people. And I'm still old enough to remember when Glenn Beck had a revelation. And Samantha Bee and the New Yorker magazine and New York magazine and the New York Times. And they all gave him profiles because he finally saw the light. And he was coming around. He's on our side now. And then it was like, oh, that didn't work out for him financially. So he's back to, you know.
Yeah.
Talking to George Washington about
exactly, talking about George Washington and how Hunter Biden and, you know.
Trans kids.
Trans kids and whatever it is. I mean, honestly, if people get duped by this again, it's willful. Let them. They don't need your help. They don't need your help any more than, you know, Steve Schmidt did. They're the same people. They're just slightly different politics.
Yeah.
Let them talk to their people if there are any people for them to talk to, and go with God. But don't get fooled by this. I mean, come on. Megyn Kelly's not an idiot.
No, she's smart. That's what's actually most infuriating about her. She should know better. But she just sells out other women for the rest of time now. So
didn't we play her like last month or 2 months ago saying I would vote Republican no matter what happens with Trump over a Democrat because they're so crazy? Like,
yeah.
As she was calling out.
Oh, and Trump. Then let's talk about the age of consent again. Yeah. Huh, but this is our ally.
With those barely legal 15-year-olds.
It's time for you to go.
That's what Megyn Kelly
said. It's time for me to go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Emma, I throw it to you. Folks, bye-bye for me. Emma will say goodbye.
All right. I'm going to read some IMs, and then maybe we'll do another clip here. Lefty from way back, is there such a thing as vote progressive no matter who? Oregon's 5th District had a progressive with good positions up against Janelle Bynum, who was taking money from crypto and AIPAC, but it seemed like the challenger didn't really have serious policies or a platform. I assume it's still better to vote progressive in that case for a House seat. Still learning.
In a primary,
yeah. Absolutely. You should always vote for the more progressive candidate in the primary if you have the opportunity. No Sleep Till says, can't help singing Booker's Michigan Fist to the tune of Chili's Baby Back Ribs.
I want that
Michigan Fist. I want that Michigan Fist. I think that's pretty well done. Yes, I think that was a good call. You know, the baby back ribs jingle just is the gift that keeps on giving.
I always say that.
I'm always saying
we're gonna be like 70 and the only generation that still remembers it.
I want that baby back. I'm hungry.
Dementia
now.
In a bed, singing it over and over again.
You eat fresh.
Lesbians Love Majority says, I would love to see Emma's alt Twitter. I don't have an alt Twitter. It freaks me out way too much to think about that.
Remember when
idea.
Jimmy got busted, I think, for that? It's yes. Like, how do you have the time?
I know. I know.
Yeah, Emma just goes wild on the regular
one. You're right. Yep. The Mill Rind, if it's the Michigan Fist, then it must also be the Upper Peninsula Elbow to go along with it. Jail Migalow, how about a call? Rarely get to call in with both Emma and Sam's present these days. Shade, mostly due to Emma's absences. I'm sorry, we don't have enough time for calls today, but we will try to take some tomorrow.
Quiet, Piggy.
I got the quiet Piggy. I removed all the airplane noise.
Okay. Quiet, Piggy.
That is very disorienting. Let's do 13. Abdullah Sayed surging in Michigan. Really a very long primary. Their primary is not until August, and these candidates have been running Haley Stevens, Mallory McMorrow, and Abdullah Sayed for quite some time. This is a really important answer from Abdullah Sayed when he is asked about Israel's right to exist specifically as a Jewish state, which you can also refer to as an ethnostate with no right to return for Palestinians. This answer here is, I think, the best I've seen so far from a Senate candidate. It's reminiscent of Zoran Mamdani's response during the New York City mayoral debate about Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state, in which he says it has the right to exist as a state of equal rights, which in that instance would include an end to the apartheid, an acknowledgement that Israel does control the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem illegally, and the ability for Palestinians to live on the land that they have been ethnically cleansed from. Expect a lot of Zionist money to pour into this race, even more so than previously, after you hear this response. But here is Abdul al-Sayed at this event in Pontiac, Michigan, Jews for Abdul event, answering this very question.
I believe that Jewish Israelis and Palestinians have equal rights to peace, dignity, and self-determination. And I often struggle with the question that people ask in this particular scenario, because what they now ask is, do you believe in the right of Israel to exist as a Jewish state? Which to me forces the question of a definition of what a Jewish state means. Are we saying Jewish by faith? Or are we saying Jewish by power? Or are we saying Jewish by majority?
Can you pause for a second?
If we say Jewish by faith...
This is a really savvy way to speak to a progressive Jewish audience that is asking you this question, because there are real factions over what that means. You see that within the context of Israel. I think it's overstated in the broader context of the settler colonial project, where there's broad alignment. But specifically when you're talking to a domestic audience here, are we talking about the theocracy that is represented by, you know, the religious extremists that are a part of Netanyahu's coalition? Or is this more about, like, the secular ethnic cleansing project? And a lot of the more secular folks are not interested in the religious rule of the fundamentalists, for example. So I like that he's pointing out these divisions.
That opens up a whole other set of questions, which are, whose interpretation of the faith? Is it Hasidic interpretation of the faith, or a conservative interpretation of the faith, or a reform interpretation of the faith, or a humanist interpretation of the faith? And do we believe in theocracy generally, right? And I would say that I do not believe in theocracy generally, and I choose to live in the United States of America as a Muslim because I want everybody to have the right to pray as they choose to pray or not pray at all. And there's an internal conflict about how you define Judaism here in the first place. Okay, if you're not saying it's Jewish by faith, then you're saying it's Jewish by power. Then the question becomes, how do you sustain democracy if you don't have a Jewish majority? And then to say it's Jewish by power, are there particular offices that have to be held by Jewish people? If so, what kind of Jewish people? Hasidic Jewish people, Reform Jewish people, conservative Jewish people, humanist Jewish people? And also, what happens then if there is a conflict between democracy and who holds power? See what I mean? All right, if you're not saying all that and you're just saying Jewish by majority, then there's two questions about how you maintain a majority. You either remove some people or you bring in other people, right? And that
Someone
creates
said
a
both.
Whole number of justifications for a whole bunch of actions that I think none of us would appreciate.
So someone in the audience there said both, which is true. That is has been the tactic of the Israeli government to encourage immigration to Israel.
To Judaize Palestine.
Yes.
That's the word they use.
And right. And to even, you know, hey, take out your second home. Hey, do you have a conviction for child sex abuse? You're okay. Come on over. We really have no scruples about who we let in as long as the demographic majority continues. I mean, I've seen that there are pitches even to some evangelical Americans and others who are not Jewish, because the demographics that are more important are Western and white versus Arab and Palestinian. That's it.
It's a time for choosing. And their most recent poll, and I've seen, And not that American Jews should determine, the fate of Palestine, but since it is relevant in this discussion, 25% of American Jews support one democratic state. That number goes massively up when you go to under 35. About half of U.S. Jews support the two-state solution. They're delusional. That's not going to happen. It's not happening. And the remaining just under 25% support what is happening, which is the construction of a one-state apartheid for Israel. We can speak very clearly that the first group, the 25% who believe in one democratic state, are the righteous ones. The 50% who believe in two-state are delusional. And the remaining under 25% are fascists. And we need to be clear about that.
And that 50% in the middle of the two-state solution people, I think when it's explained to them by candidates, you're going to get a lot more movement than you would if you didn't have this complete messaging vacuum at the top of the Democratic Party on this issue. And I, even in this way, I'm calling out some of our leftiest members who don't seem to prioritize creating a framework for a forward-thinking policy about Israel and Palestine beyond the opposition and the genocide in and of itself. It's part of why I was kind of insistent with Mallory McMorrow in my interview with Matt Bernstein about talking about the viability of a two-state solution, because more than 700,000 settlers have illegally settled in the West Bank. Like, they live there now. That's supposed to be Palestinian territory. That's very wrong. It's why settlements are illegal under international law and morally repugnant. But we're not talking in those terms right now. We're actually the ones talking in practical terms. Because the two-state solution chunk, the only vision for that would be extricating, removing the 700,000-plus Israeli settlers in the West Bank. I mean, look, you want to lock them up and put them in prison and say that they're violating international law? Or is it easier to end the apartheid and grant citizenship for Palestinians within Israel?
For Zionists, it's tough.
It's tough.
Sam Harris, before October 7, was saying that the settlers should be dragged out by their beards. Now, he didn't think that the Palestinians should do that. Then if the Palestinians do it, then all of a sudden it's violence and terrorism.
But the good news is that, yeah, right, there's no apparently state policy by the Israeli government that would incentivize such settlements. Oh, wait. It's actually one of the biggest things the government is doing currently.
Finance minister.
Is pushing for more settlements in that area because they know that forecloses that possibility, and they are operating with a shot clock. Shout out to the New York Knicks.
But that's why this whole conversation is a fucking... People should be told to shut up when they bring up the two-state solution, whether it's Dan Goldman, my fucking congressman, who, good riddance, he's going to be gone soon.
Oh, Matt.
Look at the poll, and he's gone. But, like, the two people who say two-state solution, like, they're wasting fucking breath in allowing Israeli commandos to fucking reload. That's all. That's the only service that they provide discourse.
Yeah, I just but I think part of why that has been able to persist is because of what I'm speaking about here. There hasn't been leadership on this issue. And so I'm grateful for Abdul al-Sayed putting himself out there, because this is not without bravery. As I said to start the segment, there's going to be an influx of Zionist money that responds to this, because even more, I mean, Plattner's been phenomenal, but he hasn't been hasn't spoken about it in these terms explicitly. And I think also that's by the nature of Abdul running in Michigan too, you know, where he's, what questions he's going to be having to answer. But this is a brave thing to do, and it's because this is the honest position. It's also the most practical one. We believe in multiculturalism supposedly as an ethic in this country, and Abdul talked about it a little bit there, that he was taught in as an American that a multi-faith society is something that we should encourage. And it's not just because we want to be singing Kumbaya and holding hands and making flower chains in the park as Brooklyn liberals. It's because it's the way that everybody is safest. It engenders understanding. It breaks down barriers of racism and nativism. But that very fuel is exactly what the settler colonial project needs. Nativism, fear, anger, and hatred towards one's neighbor because they look a little bit differently than you. And so when I see online supporters of Mallory McMorrow or Haley Stevens talk about how Abdul Al-Sayed can't win a statewide race, you know, perhaps I'm being maybe too cynical when I see these white people say this, but it's very coded to me. I mean, it's very much like you're going to win a statewide race with this guy. Yeah. You know what? Actually, I think you might be able to because of the strength of his message. I'm not just looking at his skin color or his religion. Because this is the common sense position. His Medicare for All position is a majoritarian position. All you popularists, Matt Iglesias, write a blog about that, as is his position on Israel-Palestine. And the more people hear this in particular, the more they are going to get it. Because the facts, the morality are on our side. It's just a question of how long we stall, as Matt was saying, for the genocide to perpetuate. That is the question that is before us now. So, Abdul Al-Sayed, great stuff, and not just money that's going to be dropped into this race. Watch out for there to be immense pressure on one of those two other candidates to drop out. Haley Stevens, Mallory McMorrow, whichever one the Zionist lobby thinks is a more viable candidate to consolidate behind. But there's going to be dirty tricks in the 11th hour here, and I hope people stay focused. With that said, gonna read some IMs and get out of here. Nicola, that said, Emma, who do you allow to stay in homes stolen and what, who not? I'm one state all the way, but you have to kick out the people who stole homes with the homeowner is still alive and demands their home back. No, there has to be a Truth and Reconciliation Committee to make those kind of determinations. It's going to be a difficult legal process.
Yeah, it's a massive, massive problem for the rest of the century. It first comes with Israel's monopoly of violence in the region is revoked. We underwrite it with our military-industrial complex. The idea that they should control it and Palestinians don't get an army, that needs to change. And it should be a demilitarized as a society. We've had Ido Alam on this program before. I've had him on Left Reckoning and Jacobin Show. He's a refusenik in Israel. I need more of our politicians to speak up for people like that and not like these fucking soft Zionist like liberals that like just want a different like Yair Lapid or whatever to be in power. The squad and those type of people should be representing people like Ido Alam, because that's the future that those are the only embers worth blowing on in that society currently.
MJS617, Emma, did you see Haley Stevens' speech where she said she sees Israel's future in her dreams? Very odd. I believe we played that. We did play that on the
also,
show.
She's not Jewish.
She's not.
FYI.
She's just a fanatic. Another example. My crop is full. Decade after decade, we've had Democratic establishment who's only offering, we're not as crazy as those nutty Republicans, which has led to weak-kneed, or if you will, dino slate of candidates who just stack loss upon loss. Greg from Pittsburgh, Israel bombed and bulldozed the courthouses intentionally to destroy records of who legally did and owned what. Yep, they've done that with a lot of historical archival material in Palestine. And, of course, they have destroyed everything in Gaza. Everything. Socialist accountant, Mark Wayne Mullen is the answer to the question, what if a leather vest was a person? Hack all the things. Emma, did you see ESPN did a story about the four alien species that have been revealed? No. ESPN? Yeah. Silicon Valley leftist, update on the California governor's race that I haven't seen reported on anywhere. As recently as May 1st, Xavier Becerra's healthcare platform referred to healthcare as a human right, linked to a clip of Becerra advocating for single payer in 1994, and was suggested he would build towards a universal policy. It was vague to begin with, but only a few days after getting the Cal Medical Association endorsement and donation, all of that has been scrubbed from his page. The linked clip is gone. No reference to universal or single payer. Even the line, healthcare is a human right, is gone. This guy is a rag for corporate donations, urging people to vote for Steyer. Yeah, that is shady as hell.
Yeah. Steyer's, relatively better and the best in the field as far as I can tell, but nobody should be supporting Becerra that hears this.
Yeah. Arun with the view regarding El Sayed and Platner and even Tal Rico, we need leaders who front line and make the case for the right choices. Democrats are just followers at best to the focus groups and at worst to the donors. There are no actual leaders. It's really all that hard. The people are just leaders who can change the conversation. exactly. It's a question of persuasion and will, and there are Democratic consultants that refuse to engage in that purposefully. They would rather the right-wing talking points fill the vacuum, and it has resulted in what we've seen. It is a question of leadership. It's a question of being able to change the conversation with your leadership, move polling with your leadership, as Trump has done. Democratic voters take a variety of different factors into account when they're making choices in primaries. Republicans, as we've seen, go, Trump endorsed. So, like, I mean, the idea that the left should cede making the case as opposed to being at the forefront of the ideological argument here is silly, but it's convenient. And two more. Megyn Kelly's chorus nemesis. I went a little too far with Megyn Kelly, but I was so mad from Ben Shapiro on. Josh Shapiro on. Megyn Kelly's chorus nemesis. Megyn doesn't respect the rule of do re mi fa so law. She shat all over it. All right. And the final I am of the day. Really quick. JR in Philly. The best alt Twitter was Charlie Kirk's when he forgot to log out of his main and pretended to be a black guy who loved Charlie Kirk. I forgot about that. Yes, that was so good. All right, guys. Thank you so much. Appreciate you all. We will see you tomorrow. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. Are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess I'm where I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Know how far the detour takes you. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining shifted in and out.